Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode 10 of the Carpcast. It's our 10th anniversary, Mark.
It is. We're going to have some cake. Well, yeah. I am anyway.
Not got any cake. I'm looking at some Starburst favourite red fruit chews, which will always go down well if you hear rustling and chewing.
It's been about 35 degrees today. I've got a nice glass of water to replace all the sweat that's running down my head.
Yeah, even in the dizzy north, we had 33.5, 34 yesterday. It's been cloudy all day today, but still been 30 degrees all day, which is crazy. Not been out fishing, would probably get burnt to a crisp, and I'm guessing the carp are sunbathing too.
Yeah, sunbathing or spawning.
Yeah, they've spawned in a fair few places over the last couple of weeks, but any that haven't, I'm pretty sure will have gone in the last day or two.
Yeah, there's quite a few videos appearing on Facebook of them splashing all over, and there's a few fish that I know I've seen in the press and on Facebook about good, 5-6 pound down in weight, some of them. So they've had a good blowout. It bodes well for the weights back end of the year.
Yeah, that's good. It's always nice when they get it all out of them, and they seem to go extra big, don't they, when they go really small?
Yeah. Look at the lady when we both caught her that year.
Yeah, definite. Yeah, I try and avoid fishing in summer for that reason. If I'm fishing for a specific target, like a 50 pounder, then I want to catch it at 50. I know you didn't. You pay all that money to fish for a 50 pounder, and it'd be nice to catch it at 50 pound, although yeah. Most people think the weight is irrelevant, but it kind of is sometimes.
It is, yeah. Well, without going into any details, I was April of that year. I was laid up in hospital with some weird and wonderful things going wrong with my body, and generally not knowing if I'd ever get back on the bank. So,
yeah, different circumstances, yeah. Isn't it? You take it. But now you're still here, God knows how many years later.
And still not having caught a 50.
Yeah, there you go. But should we move on? Loads to get through this time. So it's on the net, it must be true. So a couple of stories we touched on briefly last time when I was away in Vegas. But Mark touched on.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Well, should we start with the tight lines to end, just because it'll be a short, quick one? We can get on a roll and then dive into the juicy bits.
Yep, tight lines is ending the Sky Sports fishing programs, one of the longest running fishing programs in the country. It's ending after the Fishermania final. Fishermania is still continuing, apparently, but tight lines isn't. Keith looked a bit disappointed when I saw his Facebook. It looked like it was not welcome news.
Well, no, it's got to be. It's been his job for quite a long time, and well, I enjoyed watching it. I can't say I watched every one, but when there was a guest on that, a carper guest, I always watched or recorded anyway.
Certainly, I mean, it's kind of when fishing's getting bigger than ever. It's kind of a sign that. I know that the more mainstream channels are not interested. Obviously, we've got the Big Fish Off with Ali and Dean. They've kind of crossed over into the celebrity market. But there's not many dedicated fishing programs apart from on the specialist channels. And I'm guessing that's the way it's going to be. That's probably the end of fishing or a fishing news program on mainstream TV.
Yeah, I think where one disappears, another one will pop up, hopefully. But the thing with tight lines, it was fishing covering every part of fishing, from specimen gudgeon fishing to shark fishing. It not every episode interested me, to be honest. Do you think that could be a problem? Whereas something like tight lines, it is all carp, and is it like 9 or 10 series?
Are you on about Thinking Anglers or something?
Thinking Anglers, yeah. Thinking Tackle.
Thinking Tackle, yeah.
Yeah, the
Corder
one.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is as well, I mean, Corder are spending a large marketing budget on the TV stuff, so the way TV programs work is they make revenue from the advertising, and if nobody wants to pay for advertising in the middle of a fishing program because, say, one of the main people who spend a, who have a TV budget have their own programs to put their adverts in, they must be struggling to sell the advertising in between the program, which is generally how things work. And obviously TalkSport cut the Fisherman's Blues on the Saturday. It was a 2-hour show Saturday and Sunday. It's now a 1-hour show on a Sunday. Fishing, I believe, led to believe, is worth £1.5 billion a year to UK revenue, and yet we can't sustain a program on radio or TV. Which is disappointing. It's even though there's a lot of people go, you know, 3 million anglers in this country, it's still considered very specialised.
It is maybe podcasts of the future.
Yeah, well, you know, the beauty of podcasts is people can go to, you know, that you can get something you're really interested in. Like we've had this discussion many times, but yeah. I don't watch TV or regular TV in the fact of, you know, pre-programmed stuff. If I want to watch a box set on Netflix or whatever, I'll watch a program that I really want to watch and, you know, smash a load of episodes out. The days of just turning on the telly and watching kind of what they're telling you you have to watch is long gone, because it's all out there.
Yeah, that's right. I've just got to say, though, with this nice hot weather, I think the occasional seagull I can hear from your end just adds to the ambience of it. That's great.
I've got my headphones on there. I can't hear him, but yeah, it's usually next door's dog barking, but there is a big seagull that wakes us up every single morning about 5 a.m. I can't hear any now, though. So, you know, it's a consumer market out there now. If you're into fishing, get on iTunes. There's loads of fishing podcasts. We're the only carp one in the UK, but there is other fishing podcasts out there. If you're into wrestling, if you're into UFC, whatever it is, there's podcasts out there. And then TV's gone the same way, really, with Netflix and. There's an Amazon TV as well, and we can all, you know, with the Apple TV, you can play from anything off the internet, from your iPad or laptop. It's specialist, and people are quite happy going to seek out the stuff that they want. So I can see specialist stuff coming away from the TV. TV's just going to be cooking programs and fly on the wall documentaries in the near future, I think.
Reality TV.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, man, you mentioned recording a second series of The Big Fish Off. Did you see the picture Ali put on his Facebook? He's dressed in his all blue running suit, looking like a little Smurf.
Yeah, I did see that one. Yeah, they're filming series two now, which I'm looking forward to. They released details of it at the Northern Angling Show, it was. And they said it was going ahead. They are actually filming it now, and we hope to have them back at the next show. And I'm sure they'll be getting all the behind the scenes stuff. But yeah, they had an all ladies one last week, didn't they? I think.
I believe they did. Yeah. Can you remember who was on? I can't remember.
Is it Jessica Ennis and
Yorkshire Lass?
And I'm guessing this from Ali telling me 6 months ago. I know they were two sports stars. I forget. We should look really, but I'm not sure if Ali's posted any names up actually on his Facebook. I didn't see him.
Anyway,
let's move on. It's on the net. It must be true.
It's on the net. It must be true.
One of the biggest stories at the minute is around the Carp Society. Now, younger listeners, probably not even aware of the Carp Society unless you tried to fish Horseshoe Lake a number of years ago. Kind of the only memberships that the Carp Society used to sell were to enable you to fish, buy a day ticket on Horseshoe Lake. You had to be a member of the Carp Society. That was the case for many years after it went day ticket. The rumour is, and it's a little more than the rumour, we have to be very careful here of what we say. We don't want to slander and repeat stuff that's untrue, but there are certain facts out there, and we'll give them to you, and you can make your own mind up. But the rumour's going around. It first appeared on Facebook that the Carp Society are rumoured to be looking to sell Horseshoe Lake, which is obviously their biggest asset. It's the only place they own. They took pledges from members to purchase the lake. You bought yourself a 10-year ticket at the time. I was one of the people involved at the time. In I had the season ticket while they were getting the pledges together. I was only young, about 16, and didn't have the 200 quid or whatever it was at the time, and never actually bought the 10-year ticket. Regretted that for many, many years, but I was, you know, I was kind of involved and saving up and receiving the letters and all sorts. I remember it very clearly. So the society, it was a society for carp anglers. You wanted to be a member. If you're into fishing, you wanted to be a member. They owned, bought a cracking lake with members' money. And it's been run kind of as a business. The Carp Society have ceased to do anything other than have their yearly trade show or exhibition, which they do at Sandown every year. That and the lake is pretty much all they've done. They used to have regions, they used to have carp slideshows, guests, they used to be regional organisers. It used to be a real community, and they used to do the junior fishings. It's kind of all vanished, and they just run Horseshoe Lake as a business. The rumours have come about because of some documents that have been dropped anonymously to the angling press. Carp Talk, Carp World, Angling Times all received copies of these documents. These documents have kind of been denied by the Carp Society. They have printed a statement on their website saying that they are not, it's worded, the wording tells the story in itself. It says that they are not pursuing plans, which kind of indicates that there may have been plans, and now it's out in the public domain, they're maybe not pursuing them. But it certainly, it certainly appears that something's not quite right here. And these documents include evaluation from Fenright Estate Agents, where it's apparently valued at 1.7 million. I think there's some letters from liquidators where they've been discussing disposing of the assets. Now, I believe there's certain protections that were put in by the kind of people involved in the Carp Society when they purchased the lake, and I think some safeguards were put in that to protect the asset being an 80 acre lake, one of the prime lakes in the country, and there were certain measures put in to stop somebody going, making a profit off it, somebody going, right, that's our lake, let's sell it and divvy the money up. There were certain safeguards put in to stop that ever happening. Now, obviously things like that would have to be voted by the board. It appears, and some people seem to think over the recent years, there's been an active movement to replace the board or the old board. There's a number of things gone on, and it does seem that that has been happening. Something else that is a fact is you now don't need to be a member of Horseshoe, of the Carp Society, to fish Horseshoe, which you always have been. The membership was only like, I think it was £25 a year. They've took away the necessity to be a member of the society to fish Horseshoe, and put the membership up to £95 from £25, and also you can only actually join for 2 weeks of the year. You can join between the 1st of January and the 14th of January. So they've more than trebled, almost quadrupled the price, made it so you don't actually need to join to fish the lake, and then made it what would seem difficult to join. And then when you do join, it's not an automatic membership. It has to be accepted. In the meantime, they've introduced a horseshoe passport, which is £10. So you still have to buy something to fish the lake on top of your day ticket, but you buy a £10 horseshoe passport, which looks like it's kind of replaced the membership. Which looks suspicious to me. You know, one might draw their own conclusions from this, that they don't want members. They're actively discouraged. If you click on the Carp Society membership, at the top of the page, it actually says, "We think you may be on this page because you believe that you need to join the Carp Society in order to fish Horseshoe Lake. This is no longer necessary." And it mentions it more than once on this particular membership page that, looking at it from an outside point of view, it's trying to discourage you from joining the society.
And even if you do become a member, what do you get for your 95 quid?
You get nothing. There's no magazine, as there used to be.
That used to be a good magazine, which I had my first article in many moons ago.
Yep, and Jules, who's on the show in a little while, Julian Cundiff, was editor of that magazine for a while, so I'm sure we'll mention that.
Yep.
But, you don't seem to get anything. You can join for 2 weeks a year. The price has quadrupled. And I'm led to believe they have 7 members, which are board members, funnily enough. I can't speak for the motives of the current board, but from an outside point of view, this does seem strange. You know, we'll give you the facts that we know and you can draw your own conclusion. It used to have 6,000 members. It now has less than 10.
It's not really a society anymore, is it?
It isn't, no. There's 11 members currently, 7 of which are board and shareholders. It seems odd. Now, the rumours or the conclusions people are coming to, and I would find it hard to, you know, being a bit cynical myself, I'd find it hard to think any different, is that if the fact that liquidators have been spoken to about kind of dissolving it and releasing the assets, you know, that would suggest that maybe the people who are members would get some sort of share of that, which is maybe why they're trying to stop people being members and encouraging people to buy a horseshoe passport instead, or making people buy a horseshoe passport instead of membership. It seems very strange that you would now have to buy a horseshoe passport and not be a member of the club. Why not just make the club membership a tenner and have hundreds and hundreds of members?
Yeah, it's a far cry from what it used to be, when you actually went carp fishing and felt like it was your duty to join, to be part of the club.
Well, I'm led to believe that one of the board members has raised concerns about the motives of the Carp Society with all this kind of recent stuff, and he's kind of been pushed out. You know, it looks like there has been a plan to kind of oust the regime. David Manuel, who seems to be the main man there these days, he's living on, he's bought a beachside property somewhere, if the Facebook rumours are to be believed. It stinks. The whole thing stinks.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not the last time we're going to be speaking about it either, as this story rumbles on.
No, this is an ongoing story. And there's obviously people behind the scenes who are extremely unhappy with what's going on, to have released anonymous documents and sent them to the press. It shouldn't be allowed. I mean, the first thing I would think is, you know, get me a membership. The first thing I did was get on their website and think, right, I need to join this because someone's getting a share, 1.7 million, I want some. But it appears I can't just go and join. You know, you've got to apply between the 1st of January and the 14th of January.
And then be approved.
And then be approved, yeah. I'm going to join. I can only speak for myself, but I will be joining the 1st of January, and I hope they still have the lake. I'm not encouraging anybody else to do the same thing, but and I'm not doing it because I think I might get a share of 1.7 million somewhere along the way. But the Carp Society was important to me when I was young. I actually sent a letter applying to be a member, listing fish that I'd caught, and I was excited. You felt like you had to be a member. And it was, there isn't a society like that around anymore, and it means a lot. You know, I met some great people who used to do the junior fishings back in the day when I was 13, 14, 15 years old. People doing stuff for young carpers, of which I was one of them. And it was a big deal. So I'm annoyed. I have no direct involvement. I'm annoyed at the fact that it isn't a body for carp anglers, a society for carp anglers actively doing stuff within the scene, paid for by memberships. And I'd like to see it go back that way. So that's the reason why I will join, if they accept me after this podcast. But you would have to ask the question, if I don't get accepted, why wouldn't I get accepted? You know, I would be interested to hear anybody that does apply and get refused, because I would like to know why. Why would a carp society for carp fishing members not accept people? So if that does happen to anybody, or if anybody applied last year and didn't get it, then please get in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter, get in touch.
Yeah, Society of Carp Anglers calling itself the Carp Society, refusing carp anglers. So it's a bit fishy.
Yeah, there's a number of things. I mean, we'll leave it there for now because we've ranted on, but we want to make people aware of what seems to be happening, and you know, we'll all watch where it goes from this. I'm sure this story is going to rumble on. I know the people within the press, obviously one of the people that the documents were sent to, obviously the editor of or owner of Carp Fishing Publication, Angling Publications, is Tim Paisley, who is chairman of the Carp Society himself many years ago. So I'm sure it's something that he's extremely passionate about, and you know, not interested to see it go the wrong way in the wrong hands. So yeah. I'm sure there are people working behind the scenes to try and protect the lake, which is the important thing. You know, I spent many years fishing that lake when I was younger and want to fish it again. So yep, all a bit serious, but
it's on the net. It must be true.
What have we got next? Miles Gibson, I think.
Miles Gibson and that tatten fish, that great big fat common.
Don't know anything about that fish. Never seen it before in my life, Governor. Honest.
No, me neither. I genuinely haven't, and you know that. But it's that other one down the road I'm trying to get. But we'll not talk about that. Back to tatten.
So Miles, I don't need to say allegedly anymore, because he's been convicted and found guilty of the illegal taking of fish, which is theft of fishing rights. He's been convicted and fined, what was he fined, £600 and a couple hundred quid costs or something?
Yeah, I think it was a total of 860 quid.
The prosecution alleged that he was poaching at night in the woods, caught said fish. Now, I know for a fact that the evidence in court used was a clipping from the Angling Times. I know that Miles did not send this clipping into the Angling Times. The Angling Times copied it off his Facebook and then proceeded to name the lake. This is what was used in evidence. Now, the prosecution was brought by the Angling Trust and the police, obviously, under Operation Leviathan, which is the Angling Trust's kind of new project to stop illegal poaching and raise awareness. Now, I've done a bit of digging about the Angling Trust, because I don't like how they've pursued this. I know for a fact that the reason why Miles has been targeted, it was personal. It was the warden had him be in his bonnet. The warden chased him off a number of years ago. I know Miles didn't fish there for years. That was when kind of it was a free for all up in the woods. You know, people were bivvying up for weeks and weeks on end. Number of people did. I mean, that for people that don't know the lake, I mean, the woods never even used to be fenced off. They never used to be It's only in recent years that they've even put a fence to stop you going in there at any time of day or night. There's not a single sign up saying no fishing. You know, if, I know all the local Knutsford people used to just wander in there and fish. You know, it was them Knutsford people that stocked the fish. It's not a syndicate, or wasn't. And, you know, nobody ever fished it on a day ticket. It's a 400-yard stretch of bank you can fish on a day ticket for a fiver a day, but it's an 80-acre lake, 400-little-yard stretch of banks, neither in or there. You know, there's a few float fishermen or feeder fishermen drop on there occasionally, but no carpers fish it, or they certainly hadn't done until these fish were discovered by the poachers. Poachers, guesters. But for me, a carp angler who really, really cares about his quarry, you know, he's going to look after it, heal it if there's any marks on it, you know, look after it almost lovingly, caringly, and then slip it back, is very different to the sorts of people that are being targeted in Operation Leviathan, which are people that are killing and eating on the bank, netting, you know, casting spinners at spawning fish, all the kind of things that I've seen go on with the Eastern Europeans. It's very different, very, very different, and only the eyes of the law it might be seen as the same, but it's like Miles is now the poster boy of angling, of the Angling Trust's new operation. It's like he's the justification for this project. They made an extremely big deal of it. I wouldn't have had much of a problem with it if they hadn't have made such a big deal of it, posting it as a massive success. And for me, it's just alienating carp anglers. You know, carp anglers make up the largest amount of anglers now in the country. They're responsible for the majority of the 1.5 billion turnover from the UK angling industry. It would seem to me that the Angling Trust would want carp anglers on their side. They're actively on, you know, they're the people that spend the most time on lakes around the country, and I think they've shot themselves in the foot here. And a couple of people I've spoke to behind the scenes within the Angling Trust agree. I think it's a PR disaster for them. I'm not saying Miles hasn't done wrong, but has he done any harm? There's a big difference between doing any wrong and doing any harm, and I think using him as the pin-up boy for this is wrong, and just alienating every carp angler, people that I think the Angling Trust need on their side. Now, I've emailed the Angling Trust to come on the show. They have so far declined and just pointed me to a blog, which I think it'd be nice for the Angling Trust to come on and you know, put their side across and tell us what they're doing for fishing, because the kind of topics that we're interested in as anglers, you know, the otter issue, they're not really interested. They've not helped. The Eastern Europeans, one of the good things they've done is I forget the project now, where they've made bailiffs, haven't they? They've kind of like...
A voluntary bailiff scheme.
The voluntary bailiff scheme, yeah, which I think is a great idea. Seems to be working. They're going out, checking rod licences and targeting, using information and targeting places where the Eastern Europeans and you know, people without rod licences and stuff are actively fishing. I think it's a great thing, but instead of really focusing on that, you know, there's like Miles all over the page.
They do have a project called Building Bridges with you know, the Polish Eastern Europeans, because, you know, I know from working in a tackle shop, not all of them want to eat our fish. A lot of them generally enjoy the fishing and purring back. But this Building Bridges thing, I knew nothing about it until this popped up, and I actually had a look on the Angling Trust website to see what they actually did. I mean, where's the PR?
It's a good idea. We need to educate more than anything. You know, I've been on park lakes where there's been large groups of foreigners, and they tip up loads of loud music, boots open, music pumping out, barbecues, and then they swim out and pull a net that they've had in for 2 days, you know, and it's intimidating. I've had to leave a lake in the Northampton area because of that I believe that lake's now been took over, but you know, they were quite intimidating. And it's I mean, that's one of the main issues anglers are bothered about, the otters, and also the three rods. You know, carp anglers again are the main ones affected by the current rod license. So most people that buy a rod license and use two rods, that's fine for everybody except carp anglers, who make up the majority of rod licenses. It seems that carp anglers get shafted from top to bottom, and again, this witch hunt for Miles, and it was a witch hunt based on a personal vendetta from the bailiff, from the warden. There's no doubt about it. It was him that approached and kicked up a fuss about it after seeing this picture in Angling Times, a picture that Angling Times shouldn't have published anyway, because Miles did not send it, and I believe he did send it to Carp Talk, who honoured his wishes and didn't print where it was from. It could have been a fish from anywhere. So I don't know, I'm not comfortable just the way the Angling Trust sort of used this as kind of food for fodder for the Operation Leviathan, and then how they shouted about it afterwards. They got very mixed reactions on their Facebook, for anybody that read it. You had a few jealous people that were like, oh, stuff him, you know. It looked a bit green-eyed monstery, and the majority of people were kind of like, what on earth are you doing prosecuting an angler, you know, that's for theft of fishing rights? And I do know for a fact there was no signs up at the time. You could walk into that park without climbing over a fence, without doing anything. You could walk in, wander into the woods, pop some rods out, and never know you were doing anything wrong. Which is, of course, what I did when I caught that fish.
Are you admitting it now?
I can say, apparently, they can only prosecute for 6 months after the event. It's a lot longer than that since I caught it. I caught both. As I said, there was no sign that the lake has been fished that way for over 12, 13 years. Those fish were put in by the locals, the fish for by the locals. The park, which is, bear in mind, it's a public park, you know, paid for by taxpayers' money. So we kind of all, you know, anybody who pays a council tax in the Cheshire area, has all contributed to the upkeep of that park, and there were no signs of nothing. I mean, it's all changed now. There is signs everywhere now because of this court case. It shook everything up. Although I believe it hasn't it hasn't stopped people fishing, because the fish came out last week at £55.
It's on the net. It must be true.
And I don't believe it was daytime, and I don't believe it was off the fishing area. So no names mentioned, and well done to the lad for doing it. You know, I've congratulated him personally, and I'd like to do it on here. You will not stop people guesting lakes from mid £50 comments. It isn't going to happen. Half of the top anglers, your Dave Lanes, your Terry Hearns, have all caught fish in similar circumstances. Some on absolute no fishing triple SI waters, the Black Mirror being one of them, that's sadly gone now. There are many, many anglers caught that, and I know the Angling Times commented on the romanticism, but at the end of the day, catching these fish, looking after them, putting them back, it's not doing any harm. You know, half the time you wouldn't have even known these guys had been there. Taking a picture out of the paper and presenting it to the police. I do have a problem with it.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yeah, there's a nice bit of a feel-good story, but mainly from Lee Birch's Facebook page about his local park lake, Albert Park, when the fish were seen gasping. The aerators were broken, and it looks like the lake was suffering from low oxygen, or nearly low oxygen. Did he get the Environment Agency came out and did the tests, and I think the oxygen was low, but not fatally low. But anyway, I believe Matt Hayes himself even got involved. Pressure was put on, temporary pumps were put in place, and then the aerators got fixed. So well done to all the lads up there.
This actually kicked off the same day that the Angling Trust posted all the Miles stuff, didn't it? So I know there was a backlash on the Angling Trust at the time, and then And then people said, look, this is an issue we need. And I know initially they were, it was a Facebook campaign that got any action taken. I know a couple of the local lads took their own pump down there and were told to remove them by the police because it was council property. So they've gone down. These fish were gasping, weren't they? I think they did lose a few, didn't they? There's a few died.
I think it's about 7 or 8 went, I read.
Yeah, and, you know, they've gone down. It shows how caring the carp anglers are. They've gone down there to try and save the life of these fish. They put their own pumps in because the council's ones have been broke for over a year. And were told to remove them. Such a fuss was kicked up on Facebook. People were posting every day. You know, the full wrath of Facebook got behind this. And the EA eventually went down and took some checks. And it just goes to show these are the things that people care about. You know, these are our anglers are out there trying to save the fish or keep them in the best condition possible. We're not trying to harm them. But it's, you know, it's kind of typical. The guy was told to remove his pumps. In the end, it's been done properly by the look of it, and it looks like these fish have been saved. But we're at that time of year now where the blue-green algae comes about. You know, if we get some real heavy rain at any point and it drops the algae in the lakes, we can have problems. So people do have to be on their guard. And this is the sort of thing we want to be spending our licence money on. We want to know that the EA are going to be there the next day when somebody rings up. And it did seem to take a bit of a Facebook campaign to get anything done on this lake.
Yeah, it'd be nice if we could just get the actions needed, like in this case the pumps in, without all the red tape and crap to deal with first. Funds to fill in and stuff.
Yep, but it's good. It looks like everything's been sorted now, and the pumps are, there's a couple of big ones right in the middle of the lake, and fingers crossed everything's going to be okay down there. But Nashi put something up on the net as well today, again warning lake owners. He says he's noticed some algae in his lakes it was 2 years this month, isn't it, where he lost quite a few fish out of the Church Lake. He lost all but one of the big ones. I mean, they've all come through again now. But again, he's put a warning. You've got to be monitoring places at this time. If you can get the pumps on, then do it.
Yeah, I thought that were longer than 2 years.
Was it 2 or 3? I forget what he posted, but he actually posted it up today.
Yeah. Was Reedy still down there when it happened?
Yes, yeah, Reedy was. I think they were the ones that found the problem at the time. I think Nashi was away on holiday and but I think it had had algae for a while, and as what usually happens when a water's thick with algae and then gets a rain, it actually drops it to the bottom and it kills all the oxygen at the bottom, and it can be fatal, especially on shallower lakes. Should we do some listeners' questions?
We can do. I just thought we were going to go with the other thing that we've seen on the net is the Rob Hughes announcing his Carp Team England.
Let's do that. So we have Rob right here on the line. Rob's a regular Carpcast listener, Carp Team England captain, and we've spoke about the Carp Team England a few times, and I believe we now have some news, don't we, Rob?
We do indeed, yeah. The team was announced today. It's Monday as we speak, so yes, the team was announced today, and it's quite hot off the press.
Yeah, it's looking quite good. I mean, the first two names on the top of it, probably the names that were most controversial when other people were kind of behind the team, because they should have been the backbone of the team and were probably left out or pushed to the back a little bit, maybe because of politics. But I'm glad they're at the top of your list. That's Billy Flowers and Jamie Launders.
Well, they're a pair of absolutely incredible anglers, you know, without any shadow of a doubt. Make no mistake that these two are very, very good anglers. They are amazingly consistent. And I first come into contact with them at the British Carp Angling Championships final when I was running that back in, I think it was, when was it at Horseshoe the second time? When we went back to Horseshoe. And these two young chaps appeared, and immediately you looked at them and thought, they know what they're doing. And since then, they've just dominated British match fishing. You know, they've been very, very good all the way through. And you speak to anybody that's on the circuit, and they will always say that if Flowers and Launders are either in the match or in their section, then they know they're going to be up against it.
Yeah, they're a bit special, aren't they? I had some dealings with them when they were at Nash. Fished with them a couple of times down at the Fishermania place. I forget the name of it now. And wow, what anglers they are! And I'm sure they're capable of outfishing the best pair of any country's anglers.
Something that people may or may not be aware of, because perhaps Team England hasn't had publicity that they should have had in the past, is that Billy and Jamie have actually had an individual silver medal in the World Championships in the past. And under previous management with Team England, they've actually been involved in the England squad now for 8 years, I believe. They've had two team silvers and they've had an individual silver. Now, they've not got gold yet, but it shows that they've been around the track. And one of the things that I wanted in the team was effectively a Stevie Gerrard, a David Beckham, a Frankie Lampard, etc., etc. So we need somebody that's been there before, that's done it, that if anybody's got any questions, and that to a degree includes me as well, because whilst I've got a lot of experience of fishing matches, I've got a lot of experience of organising matches, this is the first time that I'm fishing or organising or partaking in an event which is run under full FIPS rules. They have had 8 years of experience of that. Now, in any team, in any country, there's not many people that have got that much experience.
No, that's great. And have you picked the rest of the team based on individual skills, you know, so you kind of cover everything?
I am covering everything, yes. I heard your Cupcast, which I must say is brilliant. I listen to all of them. They're fantastic. They keep me going on the road all the time. I'm always on the road. If anybody follows me on Facebook, they'll always see the pictures of queues. And it seems that when I go out down the road, I'm stuck in a queue. And the one thing that keeps me sane is the Cupcast. And I heard you talking about the casting coaches that we put together. And there was a conversation about that. And again, yes, certain people have been picked for their individual skills. We've got Billy and Jamie in as a backbone, as guys that have been there, done that, level pair of shoulders. They know what they're doing and they bring a massive amount of experience to the table. Let's then have a look at what everybody must look at, and that's form. And there isn't anybody that's got better form at the moment than Harry Charrington and also his partner, Alexi Bygrave. You know, those two are on fire, would be an understatement, an absolute understatement. And you've only got to look at their results last year to see just how good they are. And lo and behold, where are they this year? Doing exactly the same thing as well.
I don't know much about Harry other than he's filming with Mark Pitchers on all the challenges, the Fox challenges that they do. So he's obviously been match fishing a long time, has he? I don't follow the match scene, so.
No, I think he fished in the juniors. He's, how old is he now? He's 22, 23 years old, something like that. I've actually fished with him in international competitions before. He partnered me out in Romania, where we had a third overall in an international event over at that Meet 5 Awards. And he's just a very, very capable angler. He's a big caster. He is fit and he has good endurance. And together with Alexi, they just make an absolutely dynamic team. Let's talk about Harry individually first, because perhaps he's the one that has a bit more light shining on him than Alexi. And Harry last year won with Alexi the Eric's Angling competition. Now, winning the Eric's Angling competition, it was the first one. Happy days, they won it. But let's have a look at their eliminator. They won it and they smashed everyone else out of the park. They then fished the semi-final and they didn't just qualify for the final. They won it and smashed everyone out of the park. And then they went through to the final and they didn't just win it. They smashed everyone out of the park. So history repeats itself in three events there. And let's look at the state of British carp fishing competitions at the moment. Make no mistake, that the Eric's competition at the moment has some absolutely incredible talent fishing in it. A lot of the big boys have moved over to that one now, and that is the one that everybody wants to win. In addition to that, though, Harry fishes in the British Carp Angling Championships, not with Alexi. And last year, he fished it on his own. And in his eliminator, he didn't just win it, he smashed everyone out of the park. And then he went through the semi-finals, and he did exactly the same thing, won it. But the interesting thing was that he was fishing it on his own. It's a pairs match on his own, and he won his eliminator and won the semi-finals. He then went into the finals at Raysbury on his own again, was second place for an awful lot of the time, and ended up being knocked down to fourth, but one more fish and he'd have been on the podium.
Well, yeah, certainly. If when it comes to form, then it does seem to me that he's on an absolute roll, and you know, it's too much of a coincidence to be consistently doing well on different lakes, especially with a handicap. You know, if there's meant to be two of you,
absolutely. You know, he went into the singles event and podiumed in that as well, which again has got an awful lot of people in it. And this year he's back. He's fishing the British Carp Champs with another lad that we'll come to later, which is Mark Bartless. But he's fishing the Erics event with Alexi Bygrave, and lo and behold, they've just had the semi-finals of the Erics, and obviously he was there fishing with that, and what happened? He didn't just qualify. him and Alexi won it, and guess what? Everyone else was knocked out of the park.
Who else we got then?
Well, we've then got the British champions, Neil Rivers and Chris Holmes. And yeah. These are two of the steadiest pair of hands around, and their attention to detail is incredible, and they don't necessarily jump out to some people as they've been match fishing, or they've been carp match fishing, should I say, probably for only a couple of 3 years. But if you look at what they've done in that very short period of time, they're just winning an awful lot.
Yeah.
Now, there is another added advantage with those two. Neil Rivers has been involved in the British Carp Angling Championships and has organised and run events for, I think, 12 years. So he knows how events work. He's used to seeing the backroom side of things as well. Chris actually run the British Carp Angling Championships for a couple of years as well after I'd sold it on. So they're very used to being in and around competitions, understanding how it works, understanding the tactics. And you know what? When you sit back and you watch high-level competition carp anglers, you don't have to pick things up quickly if you've got a mind that can take it in. And like any good angler, they're adaptable, and you need to be aware of when a change is needed. And having watched the British Carp Angling Championships and the Erics Angling Championship for such a long period of time, they're very used to watching how important it is to be on your game in a match and move around. So then what they decide to do is they decide to enter. What happens in the first year they enter? They win the British Carp Angling Championships.
Yeah, there's some pedigree, isn't there, here?
Yes. So, you know, if you look at it, then there's we've got an anchor pair, Billy and Jamie. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt, shoulder to cry on, anchors to move around. We look at the boys that are in form, Harry Charrington and Alexi, winning absolutely everything they come to. You then look at a very good skill base and understanding adaptability. And again, you know, make no mistake, Rivers and Holmes are very, very good anglers. They fished their eliminator round this year in the Erics competition, and guess what happened? Yep. They smashed everyone out. They've then gone to the semi-finals, and guess what? They came second in that one. Unfortunately, they didn't hit, but that's only because they were fishing against Harry and Alexi. So when, you know, the Erics competition has just had its semi-finals, 1 and 2 in the Erics event was Harry Charrington and Alexi Bygrave 1, Rivers and Holmes 2.
Yeah.
Let's have a look at the second semi-final. Oh, Billy and Jamie were in that. Guess what? They qualified as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you look at the Erics as an example, and all three of the pairs are in it.
And you mentioned Mark Bartlett.
I mentioned Mark Bartlett, and I've looked at Mark Bartlett singly. His partner, or his regular partner, his former partner, whatever you call it. He fished with Kev Hewitt for a while, and Kev Hewitt is an absolutely amazing angler, and I've seen a couple of people say, what's happening with Kev? At the moment, I've still got a number 8 to put in. I've picked Mark Bartlett. He is the 7th man,
yeah,
because there are 3 sections, and I want 3 pairs that work very well together to go into those sections. Now, Mark Bartlett is effectively our first substitute. He's my Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. If you want a lead, put in 150 yards, then Mark Bartlett's the man.
Yeah.
You might say, well, why don't you put him into the pairing right from the beginning? Well, just like Ferguson runs Solskjaer, you might need a super sub. And I want a super sub that if he needs to come in, dig deep and pull a bit of magic out of the bag, then Bartlett's the man that can do that.
And you've still got a space for one more super sub?
I've still got a space for one more super sub, and again, I'm not looking for pairs for that last area. I'm looking for one more person, and that person will almost certainly be someone that has got a supreme amount of Ebro experience. And I have people in mind.
Yeah.
As you've probably gathered all the way through, I don't go into this lightly, Jamie, and I'm sure everybody listening to this as well will understand that I am taking my own responsibilities more than seriously. What will be interesting is to see who comes in as eighth, and I've got a number of people in mind, but they have to have Ebro experience, and that will be the final thing that we need to make, I believe, a very, very good team indeed. A lot of the time, teams have been picked in the past on the basis of, yeah, they're good anglers, but fishing at 120 yards on Brasenose and catching Lord knows how many fish isn't necessarily what we need all the time.
Yeah.
What we need is adaptability. What we need is an ability to catch on places like the Ebro, particularly in this situation. So my mind is still open. I've got a shortlist, and that will be announced at a later date. But I'm looking for one other person that will join in there. It will be somebody that's got river experience.
And when's the first training trip? I assume you're going over there for some practicing.
Yeah, we are. There's a possibility that we might not all go together. It might split. But we're looking at going out in July and also August. The river, by the very nature that it's a living creature, moves around a lot. The water's up, the water's down, the fish move around. The event isn't until October. So the best practice that we will get will be in September, because that will be the closest conditions that we can have to the situation there. You know, we can go there in August and the river might be low. There might have been rain in between then and the event, and it might go back up again. Alternatively, there might be no rain, and where we were fishing, actually putting our baits, we might be sitting the next time around because the river's dropped 40-odd foot. So, you know, there's not a lot of point in going out and having a very, very hefty practice a long time before, because just like, you know, if there was an event in England in September, you wouldn't practice in April for it. You'd go there, you'd suss out the lie of the land, but it's closer to the time that we get the real practice done.
Yeah, I'm guessing it's tricky with it being a river, and you know that they fish so differently in different conditions, don't they? It's nothing like a lake. So
no, that's right. And there's other massive influences that we have to take into consideration. For example, just the weather. You know, the wind can pick up there. It can be very difficult. So we want people that can be fairly sturdy and robust in weather like that. There's no room for any drama queens. In addition to that, if it's very, very hot, then this can be another thing. Bear in mind, the event is 3 days long. You know, you can get exhaustion in very quickly. So there's so many things that you've got to think of when picking your team, that the fishing element, to a degree of it, is towards the bottom end. Anybody that puts a shirt on is capable of angling. Anybody that puts a shirt on. But to me, getting a perfect team is not just about that. The angling is probably 40%, and the mentality and attitude is probably 60%.
Yeah, that's why you need you know, three pairs that work together consistently extremely well and complement each other, which you seem to have, I think.
Absolutely. I'm just, while I'm on the phone to you, things just popped up. Obviously the announcement's gone out and the thing's just popped up, a Facebook notification saying the squad is full of true gentlemen, and I like that. I like that. The you know, when you get your little notifications, once just as we're speaking, I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for how you conduct yourselves. There'll be people, make no mistake, there's going to be people looking at the team going, oh, I think you should put Joe Bloggs in, I think you should put Fred Bloggs in, he's made a mistake. I accept that. Not that I've made a mistake, but people will think that their choices are different to mine. And that's absolutely right. This is the first step towards building a squad. And as we go into next year, there's going to be more events. I'm looking at increasing it because we have a massive disadvantage against everyone else. We don't fish this sort of venue very often. Not only that, but we don't fish anything under FIPS rules. So we get one crack every year to go out into someone else's backyard, fishing under their rules against them that do it all the time. What we need to do is we need to build a squad that can go out and have friendlies against other countries. We need to get a European event going. I'd like to perhaps think about inviting people back here so we can fish against them on our grounds. Not necessarily just in World Championships events, but in friendlies and other competitions as well. So the squad will be increased to include other people, because I'm looking at various different venues and getting experts for individual venues as well.
You pick three pairs of winners. I mean, you know, winning's a habit for some people, and these people are all used to winning, aren't they? Which is a great start.
Yes, yeah. You know, when you've tasted victory, it's nice. They've also, all of them, have had their share of defeats and near misses, which I think is important as well, because it's awful just missing out. You know, it really is. We had a third, and I was absolutely gutted. You know, it was a podium place in one international event, but it was third. And, you know, I've got a bit of a reputation as being a nice bloke, and I am. I'd like to think that I'm firm but fair. People say I'm a gentleman, absolutely, and I like that. But believe me, in competition, there's gentlemen and there's gentlemen, and we need to get the gloves on and have a proper go at this. And it absolutely floors me if we have a near miss. You've got to be up there.
Well, we always have to believe that we can win, and us English think we can win everything before we go into into a football competition. So I'm certain that you've raised awareness. I mean, I for one wouldn't have took any interest whatsoever in the next British Kart Mag, you know, but by reading the kind of like the write-up after it had happened, maybe in one of the magazines, that's about as near as I'd have come. But I'm already looking forward to it now, because, you know, you're out there, you're putting it amongst the public. People are going to have a view on why, where, what, you know, as people generally do. But I think we could have the whole nation behind, or the whole carping nation behind, the fishing team before October, before you go.
Well, it would be lovely to think that, because unfortunately a lot of the time that we can be a little bit of a nation of knockers, and that's a great shame, because it would be brilliant if we did significantly well. It'd be great if we do well, but it would be brilliant if we do significantly well. And you know, anybody that's listening to this, I can absolutely categorically assure you that every single person in the team is bursting with pride. I am bursting with pride. I've got a few lads that are helping out with the back room, and I've spoken to them, and they're like, wow, this is a fantastic opportunity. Now, you don't look a gift horse in the mouth like that. What we can absolutely assure everybody is that there isn't going to be a team out there that tries harder than us. Absolutely no way on this planet. One of the lads texted me this morning. I'm not going to say which one it was, but one of the lads texted me this morning and said, see, the press release is out, just reading it, welling up as he's reading it.
Good.
That's what we want.
That's what we want. We want passion, and we hope you A, win it, and B, give it your best shot if we don't.
Brilliant. Well, thank you, Amy, and we'll let you know first if anything's happening.
Cheers, Rob. Keep us in touch with any developments on Carp Team England.
Thanks, mate. Look after yourself. Well done on a good job.
Ask us a question.
So one of our newer features, we've got a few questions that we didn't get through in the previous shows. If you have any questions for us that you want answering, we can't promise that the answers are correct.
or even sensible.
Nope, but we can give you our opinion, and that's what we're good at. So James Ernest, what are the swirly bits in the water that look like fish near the surface, but when you look in the water, there isn't anything there? Are these wind demons, and should I be scared?
Oh, you should be afraid, very afraid, because those are the manifestations of the carp gods, and they are watching you.
Well, when you look and there are no fish, that's what you should be scared of. If there's no fish in your swim, it ain't no good. But yes, you are correct, they are. I think it's a bit of a trolling question, this. I'm sure you're not serious, but yes, always on the back of the wind, aren't they? Them little kind of swirly ghost demons, windy bits.
Yeah, smaller lakes. Although it is always wise to try and please the carp gods. Although they have funny senses of humour. Even recently, I had a spum wash up in my swim. I must have pleased them. Next session, I caught a 30. And then they must have thought I was taking the piss because the turbo blew up on my car. I blame the carp gods for that one.
The carp gods giveth, the carp
and
gods
taketh. And they take it away.
Okay, we've got one from Paul Wright here. What are your thoughts on fishing for fish that spend most of their lives eating natural on low-stocked, pressured fish?
Ask us a question.
We covered Colmere quite detail, didn't we, a few shows ago, but they were believed to be natural feeders. I've spent a lot of time talking to Gary Bays, who is an expert on food and bait, all fishy wise. He just seems to know about everything, all types of fish, and he developed a bait called the Fen Mix, which was for fen draining. That had a lot of kind of natural ingredients in it. I know it had blood meal and a few things that had been found to try and wean fish onto boilies that didn't or didn't seem to eat bait. Now there's a large percentage, I mean, I don't know how many fish are left in Fen now, but when I fished on there's a large percentage of the fish didn't get caught, and you saw them from the boat and they just didn't get caught. It was the same 20-25 fish that would get caught every season, a number of times each, and probably two-thirds of the stock just didn't get caught. Clearly natural feeders, you know, they weren't small fish. So I the Colmier fish, I mean, the way that I caught them is that I introduced a spod mix of everything in it. So I had maggots in it, I had particle, hemp, corn, and I had a few boilies in it. My thinking was is I'm going to feed a bit of everything and try and get the fish onto the bait. Ultimately onto boilie. If they're eating the maggots and the corn and the natural stuff, then they're going to pick some boilies up with it and then realise that boilies are nice, and because it's much easier to fish a boilie, it's much easier to bait up. I introduced it and it worked. I did eventually catch the fish on boilies. I mean, I hooked five fish out of there and they were all on something different. I hooked one on tigers, two on the Fen mix that Gary had given me to use on there. One on corn, fake maize, I think. But I baited up regular and I had everything in the mix, including some natural stuff. And I'm sure the maggots made a difference. So, I mean, that's how I would do it. But there are definitely fish that just eat naturals, and they're quite often big fish as well.
Yeah, the other thing, I'd be careful about where you're putting your bait. If you can, like, kind of piggy bait your own bait on where they're actually feeding on the naturals.
Yeah, that's a technique in a lot of the Shropshire mares, which are all just very silty. I mean, I've seen southerners on the Shropshire mares, you know, spend all day looking for a gravel patch, and you ain't finding one. You know, it's when you're used to fishing down south and they are all gravel pits, it's a bit weird when you come across a mare. But mares have basically formed from the ice age with the ice melting, and they're generally very silty. You ain't finding no gravel, but what you do find is lots and lots of bloodworm. And the way we used to look for hotspots is every time you reeled in, you would find a bloodworm on your hook or on your lead, or, you know, somewhere along the rig section. That was standard. Every time you reel in, that's the case. But sometimes you had three, four, five, you know, stuck in the weed, or, well, weed, in the silty stuff around your lead or whatever. If that's the case, they were the spots. I would always look for the, you know, the densely populated areas. So let's assume you've got a real bloodworm bed where there's stacks of the stuff. If a fish is feeding on them and you've got a nice bait sat on top of it, they're going to eat the bait. And angler's bait's good generally. You know, our boilies, the reason why they cost 7, 8, 10, 15 pound a kilo is because they've got lots of nice stuff in them. So you would think that once a carp gets a taste for them, they're going to want to eat them. So that's my advice, is find the richest areas in the lake and fish bait over the top of it.
Yeah, and also if you want any confidence boosters for this sort of fishing, read the Colmier chapter in Terry Earn's first book. I think it's one of the best pieces of carp writing ever.
I read that chapter so many times while I was fishing Colmier. But it just goes to show that, was it Laney opposite him who banged out a yellow pop-up and had a fish straight away when Herm was trying all sorts of like natural baits? Sometimes just that blatant yellow pop-up in the middle of nowhere just works. If you remember when, like, nobody used boilies, I mean, again, the younger listeners won't remember this, but there was a time where we didn't use boilies for bait, and then the sort of Richwood shelf lives came out and stuff. It was a period in, like, the early 80s, I'm guessing the real sort of in the know people had them slightly earlier than that, but generally you know, we used to use cat food, luncheon meal, all sorts of stuff for bait, like prior to the boilies. But when them fish got on the boilies, when they first came out, they hammered everywhere. And why wouldn't it be like that on there? You find a lake that haven't seen boilies, why wouldn't it be the same? So when you bang boilies in there, the fish go, oh, these are ace. You know, let's eat them.
And I'm sure the boilies available nowadays are a lot better than the first ever boilies.
Oh, certainly. They were all about the smell, weren't they? It was all the flavouring in the old days. They were pretty much a 50-50 mix. So, yep, should we move on?
Yeah, we have Scott Oakley. All things wind-related, not flatulence, though, which is a good thing. It's a good thing you're not sat in the room with me now. Because, yeah, I've been suffering a bit.
Nice, I'll keep that thought in my mind. It's a good job I'm on the other end of Skype.
Yeah, I'm just glad the microphone has not been picking it up. Otherwise, there'll be more editing to do. But anyway, we all read about getting on the head of a southwesterly wind and on the back of a cold north or easterly wind. However, having been watching some YouTube videos of Dave Lane, he has no qualms of fishing into a north wind. So how much does a warm wind and cold wind affect the fish throughout the year? Also, when does a new wind become an old stale wind?
Ask us a question.
Well, we'll do the last bit first. I mean, when's a new wind become an old stale wind? After 24 hours, I would say. Once it's been blowing the same way for a day, you know, a day. It's not saying the fish won't still be on it, but I think when you get those, it's certainly stale when you have 3, 4, 5 days of it. Sometimes you have weeks of the same direction, don't you? And you're just looking for that change, you know, or just anywhere else. I think fish do kind of back off. They quite often move on a new wind, but they move instantly, I think, if they're going to move.
I think a lot of that can depend on the water. I remember a certain session on Pit 2, getting there just before the wind kicked up. 36 hours later, we've not even seen a fish before the action started.
Yeah, and then we, you know, the lake hadn't done a bite in months, had it? And then we had three
in 6 or 7 weeks and three in about, well, it's got to be what, 6, 7 hours?
Yeah, and we'd actually, it was a cold wind, wasn't it? It was an easterly wind in autumn, and it was pretty cold. And we'd almost given up 36 hours in. We kind of thought, they ain't coming. You know, this wind's too cold. We're starting to, I wasn't moving because I was on me last night or second to last night, but I'd kind of given up hope that the fish were turning up. We never saw one, did we?
No, not a thing. I think we even wound in and went to Burger King that afternoon.
That is true. And you caught as soon as you came back.
Yeah.
A joint PB, wasn't it?
It was at the time, yeah. And a pleasant surprise.
Yeah. I don't mind fishing on northerlies. I mean, there are warm northerlies. Just because it comes from the north, depending on how the winds are swirling across Europe, you know, there are bitter northerlies and there are warm northerlies. It's 30-odd degrees at the minute in Blackpool, and if we had a northerly wind, I'd be on the end of it. I think it's common sense, you know, when it's uncomfortable. I remember my first session on St. Ives on the lagoon, and I set up on the end of a wind. It was a real gale force westerly. And it was cold. It was June time, and the wind was really, really cold. And Daryl Peck was a bit further on down, and I remember I'd done two nights on the end of this wind, not seen a fish, not even felt close to one. And I remember Daryl saying, "Should we go for a walk around the lake?" We did, wound in, and then we walked onto the opposite side of the lake, and on the back of the wind, where the sun was out, onto, if you remember, the lawns, onto that area. Every fish in the lake was in front of there. It was just, there's me gritting it out on the end of a really strong wind. And, you know, as soon as we walked around the other side, we were like, if I was a carp, I'd be round here. You know, it was like tropical compared to my bivvy. You know, I was wrapped up in coats, and the people fishing up that end were in T-shirts. And I was just like, wow, at this time of year, when the water's not that warm, don't forget it's June, so the water's not at its full temperature by then, where would you be? You'd be in the sunny, shallow area on the back of the wind. I think it's logic for me. It's definitely logic.
Yeah, I think a lot of reason why fish do move on the end of the wind, it's not the old fairy tale that all the food blows down there, because bloodworm beds don't follow the wind. Mussel beds don't follow the wind. It's down to the undertow. If you look at fish in the river, they're always facing upstream. Now, the water lower levels are always on a good wind. They're moving the opposite way of the wind, which a dumb creature like a carp, it's got to face into the oncoming water to stay still, and it just ends up swimming that way. It's not an instinct thing. They just It's what they do.
Yeah, but they do swim into flow, and that's something I thought about quite a few years ago now, that the undertow created is always goes the opposite way to where the wind's going, and fish do swim into it. I think the other thing is it oxygenates the water down there as well. But yeah, it's not the food blowing down there, which is kind of, when I was a kid, what I was told. I don't think it's anything to do with the food. I just think it's not. There's definitely something they like about it. And whether it's, like I say, the flow, the undertow, and the oxygen side of things. But fish do like moving on new winds. I find they learn. I've known lakes where they would always move on the new wind. And what happened is, you know, it's a lake with a number of decent anglers, you know, that are very aware that they're waiting on the end of the wind, you know, for a new wind coming. And I think the fish learn that when they do move on the new wind, all of a sudden there's 50 leads plopped at them. <You know? laughs> I think they do get educated. And I've known lakes where you'll always find them on the back of the wind, and they used to be found on the wind. Whenever there was a wind get up, the carp were there, and all of a sudden, you know, after a number of years of pressure, they now don't move on the wind. So carp definitely become educated by habit or by danger, and, you know, pressured lakes, they're way less like, if I walk onto a 100-acre lake that hardly ever gets fished, I'm fishing on the end of every wind. If that wind changes, I'm moving, like, within seconds. I'm up and off. If you give me a 10-acre lake that's, you know, most pegs are full most of the year, I'm probably not responding to the winds with the same urgency. So move on. Next one.
Yeah, move on. I think next question from Steph Martin, we've kind of already answered in the question from Paul Wright. When he does ask, when there are so many natural grubs in the water, how do you attempt a fish to take your bait?
Yeah, that we covered that, really. Fish a bit of everything. Try and induce the fish onto your bait. You know, mix it in as part of some natural stuff.
Yeah. So we've got next. Chris Dyson. Easy question, this. Slack versus tight lines.
Ask us a question.
There's no good thinking angler I know that's done bobbin tests that uses super slack lines any further than fishing maybe 30 yards out. I can see the benefit in it. Have we not discussed this already on one of the earlier ones?
I think I did it as a carp aren't sheep, because slack lines to me are just wrong. Unless you're finishing literally right in the edge, they're wrong. Have you ever seen a matchman cast his feeder out and then have his line hanging limp from the end? He's never going to see a bite, and carps are just the same.
Yeah. Slack lines became a craze. It was a carp, quite right, carp ain't sheep. Most thinking anglers I know will use a semi-slack line, so kind of the weight of the bobbin is the thing that's keeping the tension on, and that's certainly for the best for indication. If you're fishing a lake where the fish are so line shy, if they bump into your line and it's mid-water and it's slack, they're still going to spook if they're super line shy. The only argument I can see is if there's no weed whatsoever in your lake and you use fluorocarbon, you can guarantee that every inch of your line is on the bottom from your rig all the way back to the bank. Then I can see a gain in it. But, I mean, how many lakes have no weed whatsoever in anymore?
You've got to be fishing a swimming pool to get that effect, I think, nowadays.
Exactly. There's always going to be something lifting it up off the bottom, and if the carp are that spooky, they're going to hit it somewhere along the way. So you might as well just have the better indication and accept the fact that the fish are going to bump into your lines. And it brings the argument of deliberately fishing for line bites as well. You know, certain times of year when location's an issue, you know, I want liners. I want to know when there's fish in my swim, especially when you're fishing low stock lakes or you're fishing quieter times of year where the fish aren't showing a lot, you know, maybe sort of in the winter or whatever. You know, I fish for liners. I want to know.
Yeah, not to mention the danger aspect of super slack lines on weedy or snaggy waters. You know, your fish can be weeded up or snagged up and it's game over before you've even got the indication and got to the rod.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Okay, move on. There's Thomas Grayson.
I'm glad you took this one.
Where do I find feeding fish during really hot summer days? For example, after 4 weeks of really hot and shiny conditions. A lot of people say fishing shallower waters would be logic because of hot water attracts carp that are heat-loving creatures. On the other hand, the shallow, really hot water tends to hold low oxygen levels. It's not favourable for fish. What are your thoughts on this?
Ask us a question. A
couple of things I'll take issue with. Carp do seem to feed. I mean, they do, when it gets really hot, you do see them lazy on the surface. So fish for them on the surface. They will take a floater. I've never seen a carp that doesn't take a floater yet. The deeper the water, the better it is for floater fishing, I find. I find the more space between the surface and the bottom, the safer the carp feel. And I think if you can get a deep lake and get them going on the top, you will catch easier. Because surface fishing's an art, and they do spook fairly early. You know, you won't catch too many before that's the end of it. You're fishing for that first or second fish, really, and it's generally done. After weeks and weeks and weeks of really hot and shiny conditions, I mean,
when do we get that in England?
Yep, true. But I mean, it is red hot at the minute. I mean, I find again, middle of the night, you know, deeper spots, middle of the night, carp cold-blooded, which means their blood stays with the water temperature. So if it's too hot for them to feed in the daytime, they're going to feed at night. You know, find your deeper areas that might be more comfortable. They go for the most obvious comfort, like we said about fish, you know, being on the back of a cold wind when the water's not at its full normal temperature. You know, they're going to be looking for the shallower, sunnier areas to get that instant heat, because they're very direct. It's very instant with them being cold-blooded. I'm guessing on really hot days you might find them in the shade, in the cooler areas. I always used to find if you found those like scummy bays where the kind of wind misses and the like they just end up covered in like a white film that's maybe come off the trees or whatever, that's just congregated in a like a bay or whatever, there's always fish underneath that, always.
You know, my first ever sighting of the Scout Common a couple of years back was in exactly that situation.
Yep, so they like that little bit of cover, so they'll be just under the surface on a sunny day. But they're in there, you know, on Fendrayton when we used to go looking for them in the boat, if ever you found that area, it was just like a little recess, not even a proper bay, just a little recess that's set a few foot back on the bank. If it was covered in that scummy stuff, there would be carp underneath it every single time.
Yeah, and also, so you're on these hot summer days, I think you've touched on it, your timing becomes, you know, the windows to catch become very narrow.
Yeah, you're not going to catch in the middle of the day. You might get a few shots on the surface floater fishing, but, you know, that hottest part of the day, if it's been hot for a while, you're up against it. But fish, you know, they will pick at food if you can manage to drop it in front of their face. And I always think the edges as well, you know, the margins are always good in the summer.
Oh, without a doubt. If you get a nice deep margin, especially I found it the other year, it was weird on it was on pit 3 on A1s. You know, by just leading around in front of the reeds, which did look good, it was just soft and untouched. You know, I had a bait there, me and this lad I was with, and nothing happened to it. On the other hand, you go under a overhanging tree. The bottom under there was rock hard, and that's where we caught. It was certainly under the trees and not on the reeds.
What Thomas says about the shallow water, the shallow, really hot water. I mean, not sure I agree with that. I remember fishing on Yateley in the car park where the average depths are 5 foot and some of the spots are shallower. That used to do bites, so the when the sun was up, 11, 12 o'clock in the morning, when it was just getting really warm. It doesn't get much wind on there either, so, you know, the oxygen isn't great because it was all tree lined, and that'd do bites out of the blue. St. Ives, the lagoon, would do bites on red hot days, wouldn't it? Out, you know, in the middle of the daytime.
Yeah, I mean, that was always a weird one with the wind. You know, because a westerly, you can be on the end of a westerly in four different parts of the lake.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a weird
one. The way it's shaped.
They did like it out in that shallow area on the sunny days, though, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, definitely, without a doubt. And also, the what was it, opposite Fatty's Point. There's that little like recess in the island. It's a long chuck, but yeah, that always seemed to that did the yellow pop up fish quite a bit.
Yeah, Ed was talking about that spot, wasn't he, last week?
He was, yeah.
That was if you could get a bait in there, you had a good chance catching the lady. I know Gary Lewis caught it from out there, though I don't think he cast. It was a bait boated, but it just goes to show how the fish loved it out there, and it was a little sun trap, wasn't it? That little
recess. Definitely. You know, you could be sat there fishing it, and you know, in your hoodie and drinking tea to keep warm, yet your bait's been sunshine.
Yeah, I think we covered that one. Thanks, Thomas. We'll do one more. Mark Smith, do you want to do this one?
Yeah, his question is, why is it that when someone on a lake or a river gets a take, another angler that could be a considerable distance away also gets a take? I've witnessed it many times on both still and running water. Keep up the good work.
Bite times.
Yeah. Do you know what? I've had, back on the Woolpack, on pit 5-6, which it's two lakes, but they're joined together by three channels that the fish can get through. I don't think it had done anything for a couple of weeks. I gets down, cast my rods out, and went to sleep. I've gone there off a night shift. And I've literally just pulled the bag over my head and I hear a voice behind my brolly. And I ignored it. I'm knackered, I want some sleep. Then I heard the voice again. I ignored it again, thinking, this fella can't take a hint. Then the voice came a third time, said, are you awake, mate? I was annoyed this time. I threw the bag off me and just says, well, I'm effing not now, am I? And he went, oh, sorry, mate, but I think you've got a fish on. And my left-hand rod was bent, tip was bent round past the right-hand rod. So, oh, thanks, mate, cheers. And I wound in a fish called Floppy Tail at £28. He'd actually come round to get me to do pictures of a fish for him. And while we did his pictures, he got another one. And that was like three fish in half an hour. And the lake had not done anything for a couple of weeks, and I don't think it did another fish for another 3 or 4 weeks.
Yep, it's good that Mark's noticed this. I mean, certain times of year you can set your watch by bites. You know, I have done loads of times, and if you're fishing a lake that's got quite a few fish in it, a better stock lake, you know, you can be up in the middle of the night playing a carp, and you can hear alarms going off all around the lake. You know, it's happened infinite amount of times to me. You know, it's when the fish are feeding, they're feeding, and they tend to be feeding wherever they are.
Yeah, I think it comes back to things like light levels. You know, it could be it's just a change in weather that affects all the fish. Maybe if it's been warm, a drop in temperature, maybe only 1 degree, half a degree.
Yeah, as we said, as we touched on with the last question, you know, just one example is if it's red hot and the coldest part of the 24-hour cycle is 4:30 in the morning and that's the most comfortable for the fish, then that might be when the bite times are. And it, you know, varies from year to year. I mean, the first light is probably, you know, if somebody said you can fish 2 hours in 24 and you can only fish them 2 hours for the rest of your life, I would fish the hour before light and the hour after light, because that change in light levels, as you said, is by far the most productive time for bites, for carp, always has been. When I was younger, it was just nighttime. 80% of the bites came at night. And I think in those days, because most people fished in the day, most lakes that were fished by float anglers, course anglers. You know, the only people that night fished were carpers. And it was quite rare then. So most lakes were club lakes. You know, this is pre the days of carp syndicates and stuff, but the odd few that were, you know, in books for the select few. But generally, most lakes were course fished. And the carp would come in at dusk and mop up all the bait. Spend all night eating stuff until the anglers came in and deposited a load more the next day. And, you know, it was literally, you'd just have to fish at night. It was a waste of time fishing in the daytime. And I think that's, you know, now we it's the opposite, really. It's probably more lakes are more fished at night than they are in the daytimes, I would say, these days. But that first light is always a time. But, you know, in the autumn time, like I remember on Wire years ago, Jason was fishing one peg, I was fishing another peg, and 5 p.m. every day we'd both get a take, and there was a 3 a.m. spot as well. You know, I guarantee when I had the fish at 3 a.m. I knew I was going to get World Cup by it. I guarantee if I ring him, he'd either just had one or he was just about to have one, virtually on the dot. And I find in winter you can see the bite times are even more narrow than like the little window. Midday is always used to be a good one in winter.
Yeah, I also, his question is, why is it? Now, it could be several reasons, which, you know, we can't pin down, but what I will say is when it does become obvious, make the most of it. You know, maximise your time during that window.
Yeah, but, you know, it makes sure you've got rigs tied so you can literally net the fish and without messing about get another rod back out on the spot. When there are obvious windows, you need to be fishing as efficiently as possible in that time. Like I said, there's always a logical reason for it. Like we said, that, you know, the minute when it's red hot, you know, the middle of the night, sort of 3-4 in the morning seems to be the time at the minute for the people I know catching. It must be the most comfortable for the fish to get out mooching. And it, you know, in the winter, that 12 o'clock lunchtime one, it's probably the warmest part of the day when the fish are out moving. I mean, I think the reason why is you just got to look at nature and try and work it out. The changing light levels is always good. Dusk and dawn has always been a classic time for carp. And the rest of it is just logic, weather dependent, I would say. You also, you know, that when it goes overcast, them kind of afternoon periods when the wind gets up and it gets a bit moody and it blows, you just know someone's going to get a bite, or two or three people will. Going on bite times, actually, I remember you talking about Horseshoe again years ago. Remembers when the fish used to move into Summer Bay. Horseshoe's kind of split into two halves, like the summer side and the winter side. You've got Winter Point and Summer Point. On the summer side, when the fish moved in, you would see like the first guy get a bite, then the guy next to him, then the guy next to him. They'd go round in a circle, and within an hour, maybe 20 people had a bite going all around the bay. It was pretty mad to watch. But you could actually see the fish moving through, the shoal of fish kind of moving through and picking up, you know, cleaning one person out, moving on to the next spot, cleaning them out, moving on to the next spot.
So, is that when you have to have a hell of a lot of bait out there to maximise when they pass through your swim?
Yeah, you'd spend all day, 10 hours. Sometimes, you know, people would be in the water, two of them, like tag teaming spots, banging out to the spot. And you'd be lucky if you could hold them for half hour in them days. There was thousands in there, though, in the early days when I fished it.
Yeah, when they're really on it, they can't half put some snap away.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think it's about time we said hello to Jules.
Yep, he's been waiting patiently. And so I'd like to welcome to the Carpcast another long-haired Yorkshireman, Julian Cundiff. How's it going, Jules?
Oh, that's great, mate. Another busy day at work, but got back here in time for you to do the... to the carp cast with me, as they say. I feel very modern nowadays. I've even got broadband.
I don't know how long they've had electric in Yorkshire, but
well, we haven't got gas, and we haven't got mains drained, so we have got broadband. So we are. It's not quite fully grim up north, but it is grim up north.
Yeah, it can be weather-wise mainly.
Yeah, gorgeous day today. I'll be out tomorrow doing some surface fishing after work. The conditions are perfect if they're not spawning. One or two lakes are closed down for spawning, which is quite right. But hopefully, maybe get a fish off the top tomorrow night's floater fishing.
Yeah. Yeah. Go on, Jamie.
I think we've got a heat wave coming this week. We've got a day of 35 degrees for Blackpool next week.
35 degrees. Just imagine how in hen parties are going to take advantage of that.
Oh yeah, they wear way less than what most of them should do anyway. So.
Yeah, I always think of it as trying to cram a pint into a half pint pot.
Yeah, except it will be a rosy red from sunburnt shoulders.
Yeah.
I just want to say. We sat in Jules' carp office. Yeah. As we say before we started recording, I've always considered myself a bit of a carp geek, but I've been outdone well and truly.
Yeah, it's strange. I've been fishing since what? I've been fishing since 1976. Carp fishing really since '83, But my mum was always an avid collector of things. And, she didn't tell me to collect, but she always took pictures of everything, even on the 110 Instamatic cameras. And I guess I just picked it up. So when I was in the paper, my mum always kept the cuttings, or when I wrote something, I kept it. And I've got every single probably clipping that I've ever been in the magazine, probably since 1978. I just love the written word. I can understand where we are in the modern world, but I love the written world. So I've been in it, or I like it, I keep it. My room is just full of everything you can imagine. I just love the written word.
I have to say, you've been one of the most consistent writers since I was young. I remember reading the stuff in the Cartfisher mags, and that's what inspired me to one day want to write, and you're still doing it. I find it hard to keep the motivation going, to do like half a dozen articles a year, and you're a machine.
Yeah, take it from me, you can't do it unless you enjoy it. You might be able to do it for 6 months, you might be able to do it for a year, you might even be able to do it for 2 years if it's your job. Number one, it's not my job. And number two, first carp article appeared, proper carp article appeared in Cartfisher in 1986, Who's Kidding Who? That's 30 years ago. And I ain't stopped writing since. You cannot con yourself to work like that unless you enjoy it. I absolutely guarantee you. Absolutely guarantee it. I just love the written word. And I like to think I've done my bit.
Yeah, you certainly helped me along. Remember the, what was it called? Your... question and answer thing you used to do in carp.
Julian Condy's carp clinic and things like that. Yeah. Absolutely. I like to think maybe I have helped a generation or two of carp fishers. And, I sometimes read about, this guy, he's my guru and my god and all that. And I think, well, it's all right being impressed by this guy who's caught these 40s and 50s and fishes full time. But the reality is, you've got to get there first. And I know a lot of lads who, literally have caught a few tench and then say, I want to be the next Terry Hearn, I want to be the next Dave Lane. It ain't going to happen, mate. It is not going to happen. It is not going to happen without a grounding. And most of them just explode like fireworks. You cannot go. 99.9999% of people who want to be Terry Hearn, Dave Lane, or whatever, having picked up Terry's book or Dave's book, are going to think it's simple. It ain't. It certainly is not like that at all.
Do you think it's as easy as getting the haircut?
No. I actually did have a haircut about, good grief, I had a haircut about a month ago, so that's quite good. It takes me back to, obviously, as a legal advisor in the court, I'm pretty unusual, I'm pretty unique in the courts in that everybody tends to look a certain way. And I remember way, way back in the 80s when my hair was maybe just a little bit longer, and my boss said to me, he says, you're not going into court with hair like that, Julian. And I thought, fantastic, 30 years I'm not having to work. And, I've always tried to be me. I don't care what anybody else thinks about me, within reason. Obviously, I've got to do certain things within the course and within life. But generally, I've not tried to be somebody else. I've not tried to be carpy or otherwise. I'm happy being me. And I never try to get anybody else to want to be me. I always try to be yourself. So yeah, I do stand out, and maybe I'm different to other people, but it's not because I want to be somebody else. I just want to be myself.
No, the opposite of the stereotype kind of carp look. There used to be pictures of you in carp mags, oiled up with your top off and muscles out, Chippendale style.
Is that what attracted you to my writing first, Jamie? I'll send you one of those pictures, Jamie.
I've still got them on my wall.
I heard.
Were you actually in the Chippendales, or did you do some of that for a while?
No, not at all, mate. No, I mean, again, this is really, really funny. It's something that maybe will inspire people. As a kid, when I grew up, probably in the 70s, didn't have girlfriends, for the obvious reason. Number one, I was quite a fat little kid. I liked fishing. My mum was a vicar, and I liked heavy rock. Now, if any four things were a deterrent to women, it was those four things. And it was great for fishing because you had absolutely no women interest whatsoever, guaranteed. So it really helped my fishing career. But as I got older, I realised, as I got older in years, that the only person that could change me, don't matter what anybody else writes, does, says to me, or I look at, the only person that can change me is me. So I thought, do you know what? I don't want to be fat forever. So I, you know, started running. I started looking after myself. You know, I don't want to just read about other people. I want to write for myself. Well, I had to write for myself and take the refusal. So, you know, whoever you are, nobody else can do it for you. Be it catching carp, changing your looks, getting a job, achieving anything. You know, it's like you with your DJ. Nobody can... Nobody gets lucky like that. We all get breaks. Somebody throws us the ball, and then either we run with it or drop with it. So, yeah, yeah. No, I never was one of those. Anything I am is purely self-created by hard work.
It's a good bit of life philosophy there. I mean, an important lesson for me in life, as soon as you realise that nobody actually gives a damn about you except you. You're the only person. No one's going to look out for you. You're the only person that can direct the course of your life, you know, other than obviously your mum, you know, mum and your dad have your best interests at heart, but they don't know you as well as you know yourself. So,
yeah, I know it's it was. I mean, I remember as a kid, I was pretty protected as a kid. I had a great childhood, and I remember I was bright, but not that bright, and I was more interested in going to concerts, more interested in going fishing, as you do. And when it came to doing my O levels, I didn't really revise. And I remember getting like 6 D's, 2 B's, and a D was a failure, a C was a pass, a D was a failure. And I remember, you know, I was in tears, and then my mum just said to me, "Whose fault is it?" She says, "You're better than that." And I thought, you know what? My mum can't pass my exams no more than Terry Earn can put those fish on your hook. It's down to you. You know, you can read every article from Terry Hearn. You can watch Thinking Tackle. You can watch the Nash DVDs. But at the end of the day, when you walk out of that car in that car park, the only person that has the motivation to get up at 2:30 in the morning and recast is you. Terry can't do it for you. And, you know, so many people miss out on that. They actually think, I can read that book and I can do that. Once you walk on that bank side, it is a whole different ballgame. And that's just like life. You know, it's there, but you have to do it.
Absolutely. Effort equals reward, and fishing's a very good example of that. You know, like you say, getting up at first light to put fresh baits on, or you have to do it. And or whatever is necessary. It might be waking up in the middle of the night to listen for fish boshing because you've not heard any in the daytime, or whatever it is. You know, the more you put in, the more you get out with everything. And fishing's a pretty good example, I think.
Yeah, and sometimes effort doesn't even equal reward. So if you knew that you did something and you would, you know, catch or something, that'd be great. And that's the hardest thing, or is it the greatest thing about carp fishing? You know, if you go motor racing, you know that if you get in a certain car and you take so much wing off the rear, you will go 2 mph faster down the straight, but you might not be so good around the curves. With carp fishing, it's not like that. I can have the best bait, the best effort, and I can be not on the fish. And the greatest thing, probably the worst thing about carp fishing, is that sometimes effort doesn't always equal reward. It might take 2 sessions, it might take 3 sessions, it might take 3 years, and that is the greatest thing to me about carp fishing. There is no guarantees. That carp don't know your Terry Earn, Dave Lane, Julian Cundiff, or Fred Bloggs. If you're in the wrong place, it don't matter whose ball is out there, you ain't going to catch.
Who was it who said, I remember this quote, "The harder I try, the luckier I get"?
Yeah, Tim Paisley has quoted that, and I think it relates to a golfer, if I think. I think it may be Jacklin or somebody like that, but that actually, he may have pitched that off somebody else. But yeah, the harder I try, the luckier I get. That's Tim who's quoted it from a golfer, but I think it actually predates that.
Yeah, it's Tim. Someone forgot to turn the phone off at Blackpool.
I put it on silent, and then I've got an alarm that goes off at the same time every night that I always forget about, because I'm always in the middle of something when it goes off. But yeah, it's done now. Everything's on silent and off.
Excellent.
Yeah. I was going to say, where I'm sat facing here, there's a picture of the 4 members of KISS. But then just to the other side is the decade fish from Nash's Church Lake.
Yeah.
That's got to be one of your most memorable catches, that one.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I have written about this, but this was quite. That was quite an emotional fish. I remember my mum died, and at the time I dealt with it quite well. I thought I dealt with it quite well. I was very motivated to keep going, but it was like running through treacle, and you keep running, and I got slower and slower. And I remember going. I love my fishing. I'm as absolutely mad about fishing as anything else. And I remember going fishing to a place we call Jurassic Park. I got to this place and I was fishing, and the fish moved, and I wasn't on the fish, and one of my mates caught a couple of fish. He says, "Oh, you have to drop next to me." And I thought, I can't be bothered. It doesn't matter to me. I don't want to catch them. And I could not understand that, because normally I'd be dropping in, I'd be moving or whatever. And I remember, I think, God, what has happened here? And it was just obviously, you know, having lost my mum, I was more interested in other things. And it was a bit of a lethargy, probably for a couple of months. And I remember one of my mates, Duff, who's the PR for KISS and people like that, and he'd been really, really kind to me. And it's like, you know, when a guy's got you to meet KISS and Def Leppard and Slash, you think, what, you know, how do you treat your mate who's done that for you? And Nash had been going on for years to me. He says, you must come and fish Church Lake, Jules. You must fish Church Lake. And, I walked around and Jamie was fishing once. And to be honest, you know, they're great, the big fish. I didn't particularly want to do. I was quite happy with my fishing, etc. And I thought, do you know what? I'll take my mate, Duff. He'd really love that because he's a massive fan of Nashie. So I thought, take him. You'll have 3 days in the theatre of dreams, isn't it? You know, it's like going to Old Trafford and have a kick around. So we went down there and, I tried my hardest. And I remember I just did everything I do, which I normally catch 17 to 30 pounders on. I did exactly the same things, you know, getting up, moving, putting the baits in the edge, doing everything I did. And all of a sudden, this great big fish wallowed in the net, 49.6. And I just remember it was just like a weight was taken off my shoulders. And it was just, I didn't feel a weight taken off my shoulders to catch a big fish to prove anything, because I couldn't give a monkey what anybody thinks about my fishing. But it was just, I fell back in love with my fishing. It was just something I needed to get to spur me on. And, you know, it was a fantastic memory. And, you know, I mean, the fish is sadly gone now. But whenever I look at that, I always think that was the, you know, I bottomed out and everything else was better thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, it's a moment of elation when you catch a big fish or a special fish. You know, it's a natural high, isn't it? So if, you know, what a better time for it to happen, you know, than the time of your life where you need picking up. So
yeah, I remember catching that fish, and I mean, I think up to then my best was probably mid-30s or something, you know, late records for most lakes I've fished up here. I remember it going in the net, and Duff netted it, and I says, is it big, mate? And I won't say what he said, but he said, I have no idea. So we sort of got it in, and I looked at it, and I had absolutely no idea how big it is. And I rang Nashie up, and because he said, give me a ring if you get a big one. And I said, I've got one, Kev, and it's a big. He says, how big is it? And I says, Kev, it's somewhere between 30 and 60. And he went, you northern, and I won't say the word, but it rhymed with runt. He says, you've been far used to catching too many small fish, Jules. Do you not know how big it is? And you know what? When he was as happy to see me catch that fish as I was to catch it, and it seemed to mean more to him and many of the people who follow me on social media and all my friends, it meant as much to them as it did to me. And I thought, wow, this is what it's all about. And yeah, it was a real, real special time to do it in front of my mate Duff, Nashie there as well. It was really, really important. Not that it was 49.6, it could have been 39.6. It was just a moment in time that I'll never forget. And if I never catch a bigger fish, it matters not one jolt to me. Not one jolt at all.
Yeah, some catches are made better with the company you catch them in as well.
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, it was just one of those awesome sessions.
Did Duff have any decent fish?
Yeah, to be fair to him, that first session, I think I had three. In fact, I had three or four. They're all good 30s. And Duff, you know, he'd only been carp fishing probably a few years. And I remember he said to me, I'm definitely out of my depth here. And we went back the next time, and Kev said, you know, come back again, you know. You let Duff have another session, because Duff had got, you know, Kevin to meet Thin Lizzy, and we'd gone backstage at Guns N' Roses, and you know, yeah. Kev, believe you me, I've got pictures where Kevin Nashie's a smile. It was lovely to give Nashie something, because Kevin is a pretty wealthy, happy man, and he tends to be surrounded by more takers than givers. And for my mate to do something like that, you know, to be taken backstage to meet members of Guns N' Roses and Thin Lizzy, I have never seen Kevin so happy, bouncing around in the audience singing Guns N' Roses songs till 1 a.m. Absolutely fantastic. Duff came back, and you know what? He completely changed his ethos. Instead of fishing next to me or doing what I did, he said, you know what? I fancy this swim. I looked and thought, I don't know why you're fishing there. And he went that time, and I think he caught a personal best mirror, he caught a personal best common, he caught a personal best leather, all in the same fishing, doing completely different tactics to what I would have done. And you know what? I was so happy for him, so pleased. And it just shows that, you know, carp fishing, it just, you know, it can make everybody's life happy.
So for people that don't know, would touch on the rock stuff. Duff is owner of Duff Press, who does all the PR for pretty much all the big metal bands around the world.
All the big metal, yeah, he does. He's Duff is the PR man for Kiss, Slash, has done Guns N' Roses, Thin Lizzy, Def Leppard, Europe, Rush. All the very, very big bands, all the very, very big bands. And it's funny, you know, talking about this, and it's, I remember all my life, I've always put an address where people can write to me. You know, you want to write to me, drop me a stamp address envelope, I'll answer your question, send you a DVD. And I reckon 30% of people don't include stamp address envelopes, but I always answer the letters, always answer the letters. So, you know, I'm getting probably, before social media really took off, 20 to 30 letters a week.
Wow.
I'm sat outside one day. I answer everyone. You know, they're all handwritten or typed or whatever. And I'm just sat outside and this letter just drops in the post. Another letter, another. I thought, oh, another question on carp fishing. And I'll never forget those words. It says, you know, I've just read your recent book, Jules, seen a picture of Kiss. I don't know if you're interested, but I am the PR for XYZ. And if you ever want to meet any of them. And it was like, that Moses, the sea parted. I thought, yeah, am I interested? And you know what? That was purely and simply because I put my address in a book and he could write to me. So it wasn't, I don't do this. You know, I don't send up these DVDs for any, you know, for any money. I don't do tuitions for money. I do it because I like to think, you know, if I can put something back into carp fishing, it was amazing that Duff just happened to pick up Short Session Success, which had a picture of Kiss in. And he saw that, wrote to me, and the rest is history. We've fished together, we've been to gigs together. Absolutely incredible. You know, it's been a massive change in my life, and I can't thank him too much.
It's great, isn't it, how you just meet somebody like that. And like you say, you've done it by, it's kind of the pay it forward thing, isn't it? You've put something out there for no real gain, and then something's great, you know, has come from that. And just goes to show, it's nice to be nice, isn't it? And
it's nice. It's just as hard to be nasty as it is to be nice. And I think, why can't people just be nice? People are people, aren't they? And it's, you know, not me to really judge people. But, you know, Duff is one of my mates, and I watch him at these concerts. And, you know, the music business is a cutthroat business. Nobody has a bad word to say about the guy. I mean, I'm sure there are people who have a bad word to say about me, but generally, I would hope not. And, you know, you go to the and everybody, whether they're opposite PRs, they have other bands, they're in bands, all they say is good things about the guy. And I think, yeah, it's nice to be nice. And he is the most unassuming guy, and yet is liked for just being nice. He doesn't have to be. I've never heard him say a bad thing about, even by acts that perhaps haven't done him a favour, he never has anything bad to say about. And I thought, you know, that is, if you can't say something good about somebody, don't bother.
Don't say,
you know, that's what I try to. We all have a little gossip now and again, because that's what makes the world go round. But if you can't be nice, don't bother.
I bet the internet comments kill you then, don't they? Because the internet seems to give people an outlet for all their negativity and shite they want to post.
To be honest, it doesn't bother me. I remember Dad saying years ago, the only person that you have to answer is to yourself. He says, so when you wake up in the morning, you wake up and you look in that mirror, only you know whether you're a good man or not. And, you know, somebody can say to me, if you think about it, criticism is only valid if it's real. So somebody could say to me, I think you're the most fat, skin-headed twat ever, pardon my expression.
Yeah.
But if I know I'm not that, doesn't mean anything at all. Doesn't mean anything at all. So criticism usually only hurts if there's a degree of truth in it. And we've all been subject to criticism. And when it's true, it bites a bit and it hurts. And you then change your approach. So if somebody says something to me which is true and maybe I need to rethink things I do, then that's good. I don't have a problem with criticism. But when people say stuff which just isn't true, we just laugh about it. It's just pointless. And it's in one ear, out the other ear.
Yeah, there's a difference between constructive criticism, which can be helpful, and just your internet trolls.
Yeah, they're by and large gone. You know, they don't bother me at all. You know, you get one or two people who'll have a little go, but generally I would say 99% of the carp population that I deal with are wonderful people. They're just lovely, lovely people.
Yeah, I've got some there. Well, there's one on the other end here. great mates who are fishing, and I think it's just, a society where the wrong ones stand out more, but there's so many more nice people.
Yeah. It's, you know, you wake up in the morning, if you think negatively, the world will be negative. I just try and wake up every day with a smile on my face, whether I'm catching a 9-pounder, a 19-pounder, or a 39-pounder. I guarantee you, look at my pictures, no matter how big that carp is, the smile remains the same, which probably sort of a bit like a crib off Led Zeppelin, that, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah. The song remains the same.
That's right, yeah, yeah. So I just carp fishing makes me happy. If it didn't, I wouldn't do it.
It has to. I mean, the dedication you do, and we all know that you work, and you kind of work at a 9-to-5-ish job, but yeah. I mean, you're the king of the overnighters.
Well, yeah, yeah, I think, yeah, maybe I am, maybe the king. I mean, when I started, I probably started carp fishing early 80s, and like everybody else in the 80s, you went fishing at weekend. You fish weekends. And I remember as I grew up, I thought, carp fishing's great, but girls are quite interesting as well, and concerts are quite interesting as well, and things like that. So, weekends were like, do I go fishing? Do I go out with a girl? Do I on my motorbike? And it was that, bouncing between things. And then I realised that virtually all the carp in those days were being caught in the hours of darkness. So you'd catch them, from 10 at night till 4 in the morning. And then from 4 in the morning till 10 at night was the most boring waste of time I could imagine. And I woke up one day and I thought, do you know what? I wonder if the carp realise they can actually be caught midweek. And at those days, nobody did overnighters. I cannot, people tell me they did, but certainly nobody wrote about it. And I thought, do you know what? I'll try and I'll do a Thursday night and, I'll have Friday off work. And I went that first time and I caught fish. And thereafter, I thought, well, this is simple. I would just do overnighters after work. But it is very, very hard work. I started doing those in 86. So in 86, I was 23. We're nearly 30 years on, I'm nearly 53, yeah. And no matter how healthy you are, it is hard work. It is hard work saying, I'm going to recast that at 2:15 in the morning. Mr. Bream, that's okay, you are a fish. So yeah, it is hard work.
Yeah, I remember my last ever overnighter was on Thorpe Marsh just up the road.
Yeah.
7-tench.
Yeah.
I vowed never to do any again, I was shattered.
But I think as you get older, you appreciate things. So when you start doing them and you're young, if it's not a carp, you've wasted your time. But as you get older, you actually go, I'm a carp fisherman. I'm not particularly a carp catcher because I go carp fishing. And if I catch carp through my efforts, that's great. And I'm more interested in going carp fishing. I have to enjoy it. If I do not enjoy where I'm fishing, if I don't enjoy the people I'm fishing with, if I'm not happy, I can't see the point in it. So I fish places I'm happy with, companies I'm happy to be associated with, at times I'm happy to do it. And sometimes I catch, and sometimes I don't catch. I give it the same effort. And if you're ever thinking about, what a waste of a night and my life's rubbish, you look what's happened to the world today. You weren't on a beach in Tunisia, you weren't being decapitated in France. And really, sometimes you have to say, do you know what? It actually wasn't a crap night, like, was it last night? I went fishing, I made the choice, I'm now going to work to earn money. What have I got to beef about?
It must kill you for the rest of the week, though, if you do get, if you get on the shoulder bream and you're getting liners all night.
No, I'm quite cool. I need probably, I would say, maybe 5 hours of sleep a night. I only need 5 hours of sleep a night. I'm very careful. I'm fairly healthy. I keep myself healthy. I drink loads of water. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't eat bad food. We can all laugh about it, but I tell you what, the healthier you are, the easier it is to have less sleep and to be, more determinedly efficient. So I tend not to take a load of food fishing. I tend to, drink decaffeinated coffee. I tend to eat bagels, bananas. I mean, if there's anybody there, I'll scrounge food off them. I'm the worst scrounger in the world for biscuits. But if you eat, you are what you eat. If you eat rubbish, then generally, by the time it gets to midnight and 2 in the morning, you're feeling a bit grumpy. And, you eat crisps and Mars bars all day, and they'll give you a natural high, very short, but you won't want to get up at 3:15 and recast. So, you are what you eat. So, yeah, I only need a couple of hours a night. I can do 2 or 3 overnighters in a row.
Wow, 2 or 3 in a row.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore, even after all these years.
Yeah.
So what's in your average day in your life?
Average day in my life, let's say I'm going fishing midweek. My average day in my life is I'll wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning at home. Obviously, if I'm going fishing, I can't go on the train to work, so I'll have my breakfast at home. I'll leave home about 7-ish. I'll be at work for 8. I'll work whatever my hours are. Sometimes, and you have to be determined, I can't say I'll finish court at 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock. And it's a mental thing. If you get into your head, I need to be away from work at 4. I need to be away from work at 4. I need to be away. If you're not away at 4 and you're away at 5, your head can start playing tricks on you. Oh, well, that's it, waste of time, no point going, every swim will be taken. And it's your mindset that's more important. So I have got it into my head that unless there's something majorly wrong, if I say I'm going fishing, I'm going fishing. Whether it's 4 o'clock I finish, 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, I'll drive there. And whether there's one person there or 12 people there, I'll keep doing it, you know, because we can all come up with reasons. I can come up with reasons not to go. It's too hot, it's too cold, it's windy, it's not windy enough. The fish are spawning, they're about to spawn, they just spawned. I can't get in the peg I want. The fish have been hammered, they're not coming out. You know, I could come up with a million one excuses, but you don't know until you actually try. So, you know, my average day is I'm working, you know, I'm certainly in work for 8 to 8:15, and I might leave at 4, I might leave at 5. I won't be at the venue till 6. And if I fish all night, I'm probably not set up and cast until 7. My alarm will be set at 4:30, 4:45 in the morning. I'll start packing up at 5:30, 5:45. I'll be away for 6. I'll be having a bath and getting changed for 7. Then I'm on my way to work.
That's graft.
That is graft, yeah. That is graft. And that is, you know, that's what people say. They all think, yeah, I could do that. They can't do it when they're 17, never mind 27, 37 or 47. And I couldn't do it unless I enjoyed it. If I didn't enjoy it, I couldn't do it. Believe you me, you can't do that if you don't enjoy it.
Yeah. We know about, you know, things playing with your mind. That's what, remember, Jamie, you used to tell me off for that, called it the wobbles.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mental game of fishing is as key as any of it.
I think the mental side of fishing, I think time is the most important, because without time you can't go fishing. So time to me is the most important, but the mental game is the next one. Is absolutely, in fact, I wrote a series about it called Mind Games for Cartwheel probably 10 years ago, and I remember all these people were taking the mickey out of me. What do you think this has got to do with it? What's food, health, balanced life? And now they're all writing about it, vitamin tablets and this and that. And mindset is the one thing that's settled, that absolutely is your difference. If you are absolutely determined to catch, and you're absolutely determined to keep doing it, you're absolutely determined to get up in the middle of the night, mindset is the thing that you can't buy. You can buy rods, you can buy reels, you can give your job up, you can have the best bait in the world, you can sit there forever. But if you have not got that mindset that is important to you to catch, recast, to clip the tree on the cast, to spend an hour plumbing, to move in the middle of the night. If you haven't got that mindset, you can't buy mindset.
Where I've seen it affect people most is on like low stock lakes, where there aren't many fish, and you know, there's certain people that are just not geared up for low stock lakes. They just think it's pointless. There's fish nowhere near me. I'm never going to catch. And because of that, they don't fish properly, or they don't enjoy it even more so. And they don't want to kind of persevere, because they just think this is an absolute waste of time. And I'm the opposite with low stock lakes. You know, it's just more of a challenge. It doesn't, maybe I'm just too used to blanking. So
I think the thing is as well, when you go fishing, you absolutely have to be clear about what you want. There are some times when you want to go, you just want to sit there, you want to chill out, you want to put the rods out there and thereabouts, you want to get a bite or two, maybe read a magazine or chat with your mates. That's great, that's not a problem. But if you are wanting to catch big fish, or, you know, really lift your effort up, you have to accept that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You can give 100% and get nothing. You can give 100% and get nothing. I've seen guys give 10% and get fish. And you have to keep your mind in order, because that is the only way around it. You know, mind is, you know, you have to say, I don't care whether I'm going to blank, because I'll be back tomorrow, and I'll be back tomorrow. And I don't care if I have to get up in the middle of the night and I don't get one. If it matters to you, it's the easiest thing in the world. It's the easiest thing in the world if it matters to you. It's if it doesn't matter to you. It's clearly it clearly matters to Dave Lane, Jim Shelley, Terry Hearn to catch very, very big fish and to put themselves through what they do. Because it matters to them, I think they must do it and think, well, I don't understand what the problem is. You know, why are other people not doing this? It's because it matters to them. But you can't put your mind in somebody else's mind. You cannot teach mindset. You can talk about it, but you cannot teach it. You can't buy it. You can't sell it. it is such an important thing.
Yeah. Sorry, Mike, go on.
When you mentioned mindset, I've got to ask, with the amount of writing you do, as Jamie says, you're a machine.
Yeah.
Have you felt under pressure to catch the fish?
No, never felt under pressure to catch. The only time I ever felt pressure was self, you know, it was really self-done. So this was probably in the early 90s when it was, I think I caught about 40 20s in 1 year. And I think I caught 43 1 year, and the next year I caught 45, or something daft like that. And I remember catching this fish and looking at it, putting it back and thinking, I don't even remember what you look like other than you were number 45. And that is absolutely appalling. And I remember that was probably 93 or 94. And that was the last time I ever, I wouldn't say felt pressure, but actually fishing became a numerical thing. But no, I do not feel pressure at all. I could not give a monkey's what people think about what I've done. I need to write regularly. I enjoy writing. You know, I write stuff because I enjoy it. You know, I couldn't do this if I didn't enjoy it. You know, if you... You and Jamie both write. You know that if you are not inspired to write, it's the hardest thing in the world, isn't it?
Yeah, I've got to be in the mood to do it. That's for sure. What gave you that passion? Like back in the early days. I mean, you were. I want to move on to the Carp Society in a bit because you're obviously involved.
Yeah. I've got stuff to say there.
I'm sure you have. That this show is going to feature a fair bit of the about the Carp Society and what's going on at the minute. But I mean, you were there when it was great. I mean, I remember meeting Baz Griffiths. On the bank of a lake in the southwest in the close season. He was trying to get me to come up to the fishings at Horseshoe and stuff. I mean, it was a community, like when I was young, which is, yeah. I'm talking like late 80s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which is a time, you know, when I first came across you in the Carp Fisher magazine, it was like you wanted to be a member. You felt you had to be a member of the society. It was a society for the hobby that you were into.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, was it all kind of that era that gave you the passion to keep going? Or
I think the thing, the passion to keep going is my mum, not many people know, my mum was, although she was a deaconess, think of it as a female vicar, she was one of the first female vicars, and my mum was a prolific writer. She wrote, I'll get in trouble with my sister for not remembering, but I think my mum's done either somewhere 12 or 16 books. So she was a prolific writer. She had a regular weekly column she wrote, and writing was her passion. When I was at school, I was pretty rubbish. I was absolute. No, in a grammar school, the problem with grammar schools, you're either one of the chosen few or you weren't. And I wasn't particularly academic. I could get C's and B's in O levels, but I wasn't seen as as a flyer. The only thing that I was particularly good at was English. I was so bad at French that I remember Madame Drain just said to me, Julian, just sit at the back, keep quiet and read Anglian Times, because you'll never be any good with French forever. Now, but the English, I found English writing dead easy. And it was something that one teacher, Eric Taylor, took interest with me, and he helped me write. He showed me how to write, and it was something that I actually found that I was good at. So when I started fishing, I actually thought, wow, I'd like to write about what I'm doing, because I read a lot of stuff, but it was really not helpful. Jack Hilton stuff and all that stuff, that was great. It was very passionate writing. But when you went on the banks, it's sort of like, well, what do I do now? What size hook? You know, what size bait? What do I do here? And I found that, you know, it's very hard to believe nowadays with there's so much information overload. Believe you me, in the early 80s when I first started reading, there was no information as such. There was lots of articles about carp fishing, but there was no, this is how to do it. And I thought, this is a niche market. So I thought, I'm going to actually say, use a size 6 boilie, or a size 6 hooks. I actually started giving information, you know, you want an 8-inch, you know, hook length, and it needs to be made by such and such. So I was one of the first people to actually nail my colours to the mast and actually write instructional work. And I realised that the more I wrote, the more it was appreciated. So it was never hard work. I actually love writing. You know, I could sit down tonight and do 2,000 words in probably an hour and a half about tonight. It was never hard, but it was a passion. And, you know, Tim Paisley was the man who probably impressed me more than anything. And he was a hard taskmaster, was Tim. You know, he worked as hard as possible, and he expected those people he was associated with to work as well.
Where was your first article?
My first ever article in a magazine was Write to Billy Lane, and that was in Course Angler in 1978. So that was my first ever writing when I was, I think, 14 or 15, and that was in Course Angler. Then when I started fishing for specimen fish, I joined the what was known then as the National Association of Specimen Groups, NASGA.
Yeah,
and I remember writing when I caught some nice tench from Drax in one of the magazines about tench fishing in their magazine, and it was a stapled together black and white one with maybe a photocopied colour cover. It was called Freeline in those days, and I wrote about that. And you know, you'd write occasionally, and it was quite a buzz to see your name put in print. And then NASGA became NASA, National Association of Specialist Anglers, and I started writing there. And I started writing quite regularly, and I remember reading Carpfisher, the early Carpfishers, which were incredible. They just were in a different league. And I remember catching a few nice carp at Drax. And I wrote a letter to Tim and said, I've written this article, and it's called Who's Kidding Who? And it was about somebody who was trying to pretend that these 19-pounders were 27-pounders. And Tim wrote back to me, and funny enough, I just showed Mark that letter tonight. And that appeared in Carpfisher. Tim obviously thought, God, this guy can write a bit, and he's obviously a bit of a grafter. He can become my, he can help me. He's keen as mustard. And that's how it grew from there.
So you started off writing for Carpfisher, and you became editor as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I became after about a year and a half of, you know, I was a real keenie, and I'd go to all the meetings. And I didn't have a car in the 80s. My dad would, you know, run me to fishing meetings. I would select, I really shouldn't say this, but it's true, I selected girlfriends, not on attractive qualities, but did they have a car? And, you know, I would have girlfriends who ran me to fishing meetings. You know, that didn't really last very long, because it was clearly fishing meetings were not top of the agenda for girls nights out. And that's how it went. And, you know, eventually I started going to Tim's when he lived at Cemetery Road. Didn't have a car then, so I'd catch the train. There was no expenses in those days. I simply caught the train on my own, you know, money. I would go to Tim's and we'd put Carpfisher together. There we'd be, you know, typing stuff up, he'd be telling me what to do, we'd be cutting bits of paper up, we'd be sticking them down. And Tim was a hard taskmaster, you know, he is the greatest inspiration for work. But we'd work till 12 midnight, and you know, we'd be putting Carpfisher together, and then Tim would say, well, it's time we went to bed. So he'd go into his room, I'd sleep on the couch. 4 o'clock in the morning, the bloody line would come on. Right, Jules, back to work. Yeah. I think, what? And you know, no, you know, Tim would say, I'm inspired to write, Jules. And I think, oh, well, okay, fair enough then, so am I. And that's where it came from. Tim, absolutely, Tim Paisley was, you know, the hardest taskmaster. He was a great giver, but tell you what, he threw that ball, and he didn't expect you to drop it. He didn't let you drop it, you know. And obviously from there I became features editor, and then eventually became, I did some editorial work for it on its own. So that, you know, I was really proud of that. You know, it was a massively impressive moment in the mid to late 80s, I think about 88, to be appointed features editor and then joint editor with Tim. I was so proud.
And it was a much smaller community in those days, the carp scene. I guess if you're on the inside of it, it was quite a small niche, getting to hear about lakes and obviously...
It was fantastic. I mean, I was going to steering committee meetings with Tim. And, you know, I was a guy who was, you know, I think my best fish at the time was 24, 25 pounds, which, you know, in the 80s was a good fish. And I was going to these meetings, and I was meeting Bob Jones. I was meeting Roger Smith. I was meeting, you know, the top guys from the day, Clive Dietrich, Johnny Allen. I was meeting these guys, and Tim would introduce me as his friend, and they would take me in their confidence. You know, I was taken to Savvy, I drove down to Savvy, my Golf Driver. I went around there with Peter Brock's up. You know, I worked my cotton. There were no expenses. I wasn't paid for any of this. This was just, I absolutely love carp fishing. This was, although it was a job for me, it was, you know, it wasn't a paid job. And, you know, I got to see these places, but I would hope that, you know, I gave back. And it was just incredible to meet heroes. You know, they were my fishing heroes. But I do remember meeting these guys and thinking, you're not doing anything I couldn't do. You are fishing waters I don't fish. You're fishing for longer than I am doing. But at the end of the day, dumbing it down, we're all pretty similar. And I thought, yeah, I could do this. You know, and I did.
And were you onto the latest rigs and the latest methods before everyone else?
I wouldn't say I was. I wouldn't say I was particularly the guy that really formulated that was Andy Little. I met Andy through winning a crafty catcher competition, and the prize was either £50 of bait or a day's fishing with Andy Little. Now I can tell you what you know that's like saying, do you want 10 Thin Lizzy LPs or do you want to spend a day with Phil Linnett back in the day? There was no comparison.
Yeah,
didn't have a car, so I caught the train from York, dressed in all my fishing gear, sat in the guards compartment with all my fishing gear. I mean, that did not look cool. Then got off the train at King's Cross, got a taxi with all my gear to I don't know what station it was, then caught a train again. Andy met me in Aldershot, stayed overnight at his house. We went fishing at Willow Park, and then I had to do it all the way back again. And I thought I was pretty good, though. So I thought, I'm not a bad carp angler. I watched Andy fishing and I thought, Jules, you're hopeless. This guy was in a different league. If I was using size 8 hooks, he was using 12s.
Wow.
If I was using dental floss, he got dental floss cut in half. It was I was using pop-ups, he was squeezing the pop-ups so they're critically balanced. I was using bobbins, he was using the early Fox hangers, you know, the swingers.
Yeah.
He was in a different league. And Andy, I watched him and thought, yeah, I need to up my game. And, you know, fishing with Andy and things like that taught me that there is a different level. You know, I watched Andy. If Andy saw a fish roll, he didn't just wind in and look in as he was winding. He watched that fish roll. He wound in. His eyes never left the lake. As he wound in, he swung it in. He felt the point of the hook. If it was sharp, he recast in where that fish had rolled. He never took his eyes off the lake. He'd make me a cup of tea. His eyes never went off the lake. Whether he was fishing for 7 pounders, 17 pounders, or 27 pounders, he was just as keen. He was a machine, and really, I suppose that's where I get it from, you know. So, yes, I did get advantages. I was first on the bent hook, the big hook, some of Zen and Bojko's mixes, some of the big fish mixes. But, you know, generally, I was probably the same as everybody else, but with a few, I was determined.
You just mentioned big fish, which is obviously one of Nutrabait's long-standing baits.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get onto sponsorship game, because you've been a big part of that as well. You've also been loyal to...
I was always taught loyalty. When I started, I had no sponsors. There wasn't such a thing as sponsorship, really, when I started in the 80s. And the first people that really showed an interest in me was Nutrabait. I went to Tim Paisley's house, and he got the original bait there, which was Bengers, Davina, bodybuilding stuff, bit of casing. Nutrabait hadn't even started then. And I remember SBS, Cornish ice cream, strawberry jam. He gave me the ingredients, and, you know, we did stuff like that. Then Nutrabait came along, and I remember getting the first letter from Bill saying, we can't give any bait away, but we can do you them at trade. And certainly from when Nutrabait started, 1988 or 86, I'm not sure, somewhere around then, certainly until the late 2000s, I only used Nutrabait, despite many offers from numerous bait companies. I've been loyal to Nashi. Nashi was the first person who took an interest in me. Nashi took an interest in me probably late 80s when he was working for Daiwa. And he arranged a deal where I got SS3000s, the AKM amorphous rod, the Daiwa Sensitron. Remember that? And Nashi was always loyal to me. Now, it's been a two-way thing. You know, I was a consultant for Nash, then Kevin wanted different consultants. He wanted the Jim Shelleys, the Terry Hearns of this world. And so I wasn't retained as a consultant. I ain't got a problem with that. It was a business thing. The thing with Kevin that I always respected, whether I was a consultant or not, we were still mates. Still got the Christmas card, still saw me, and I was still the same. I never forgot. So if somebody said, what did you catch that on? If it was when I was a Nutrabait consultant, that's what I said. When I was a Nash consultant, that's what I said. So I've always been straight up about what I've used. You know, I don't forget the past. I read somebody's articles nowadays and think, do you not remember whose baits you were on? You know, they'll talk about seasons they've had, great years they've had at wherever, and then they'll just put pictures of their latest gear saying, I use chods for all my fishing. But yeah, you maybe did then, but what about the ingredients you used then? And, you know, I think it's a bit disingenuous for some of these guys to forget their past. I'd rather be honest and say, that's who supported me. This is who supports me now. And I would think that everybody I've been sponsored by, I've always given back more than I've taken.
Yes, we could do a whole show on loyalty and company jumping and I mean, it's too old to be worried about those sort of things. But, you know, like I say, I just smile wryly.
It works both ways. It works both ways. You've got to remember that there are companies who will drop you at the drop of a hat. And there are anglers who will drop companies at the drop of the hat. But generally, by and large, you know, we tend to stay with the same people. And I do think anglers sometimes do themselves no favours. You know, you can go from one company to another and absolutely publicise that company to death. That doesn't mean you're going to sell fishing tackle. You are simply raising the profile of that company. But what you're doing is you're simply devaluing yourself. You might add value to that company, but you are completely devaluing yourself, because they'll say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? Because he was X last month, he's X this month. You know, it's, you know, and I think some anglers simply are recognised for the company they're in rather than their own angling ability. And I always think, you know, if you work with X, Y, or Z, you'd never be in the magazines again. Nobody had a clue who you are. You are simply there because of who you're linked with.
Yeah, and then there's a public perception, which is kind of the opposite, which is, you know, I'd catch what you got if I got free bait or unlimited this or unlimited that. And they kind of forget that, you know, you've generally, to be in a position, you know, to have a relationship with a company, you've generally done something significant of note. For a period of time before that, to get in that position. But it seems to be a life goal for a lot of young anglers these days.
But I don't know why. I mean, the days of it making a difference were, you know, Richie caught the 45-12. Everybody knew that it was on a pucker salmon boiling. You know, nowadays, it does not make any difference. I read Carp Talk, fantastic magazine. I can't remember what was on the front of the last Carp Talk.
No.
And I defy anybody to think what was on the front of the one before that, because it doesn't really matter. It's not going to sell tons of gear. And the guys that, you know, the guys who want to be sponsored, you know, I know the realities of sponsorship. I know what guys are getting paid or not getting paid. 90% of people will never get paid to go carp fishing, never get any money whatsoever. The best they can hope for is a discount bait or discount tackle. They may then get it at trade. They then may get it at cost. And then eventually there are a few who receive bait or tackle free, and that's limited. The amount of guys who receive remuneration to go carp fishing, I would say, is 1% of the guys who get sponsorship deals, maybe even 0.5% or smaller. And I would think the amount of guys who can afford to not work and have a lifestyle that is comfortable is 0.00. I can only think of two or three people at the very most. And we're not talking Jags, we're not talking Bentleys, we are talking go to the Carp Society conference, go to Five Lakes, see what guys are turning up in. They ain't turning up in AMG Mercs.
No.
It is not football. It is not football. And that's the guys they're thinking that they're going to make a living for it. You are not going to make a living for it. If you want to go full time because you enjoy your carp fishing, do it. But do not expect to go carp fishing because you're going to get a wag and 50 grand a year. You are not going to get that. You're going to get a munter and nothing else.
No, it's there's no money in it, you know. The only people that do make money out of fishing are the manufacturers. And if you're going to manufacture something, that's hard graft.
Every firm that works, Jamie, there are loads that go under.
Yeah,
you know, we all see Nash, Corda, Fox, people like that, Guard, you know. But for every one of those, there are hundreds that just bite the dust, having remortgaged their houses, given up the jobs, and gone to the wall. You know, it's not an easy world out there.
No, and if you're in the manufacturing game, you could be manufacturing anything, but you're not going to have the time to fish that you want. You know, the fact that you're making plastic bits of terminal tackle is, you know, you could be making anything.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, it's not the dream of working in the fishing industry.
No, I always had the dream. I never wanted to make a living from carp fishing. I always just wanted to think that I'd given something back. I've got a nice job, I enjoy what I do, and I thought, yeah, I want to give something back to carp fishing. Yeah, I want to earn some money from it and have a nice few things. But it was never my dream to give up work to become a full-time angler, because I meet all these people who have, and nobody seems to enjoy it anymore. They say, I can't go fishing enough. I never wanted to be in that position. I've never woke up and thought it's a job, ever.
How have you seen the industry change through this sort of 25 years? I mean, you've been kind of involved in the industry from the off, it seems, with the, like, say, from Tim Paisley taking you under his wing early doors. I mean, what are the biggest things you've seen change?
I think the biggest thing is the sheer amount of smaller companies that come in. In the olden days, you could literally name the big six bait companies, you could name the big six tackle companies, and they had the market to themselves, no doubt about it. Nowadays, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of bait manufacturers. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of tackle manufacturers. Many reproducing exactly the same thing. And I ain't got a problem with that, because that's the way the world is. So what I've seen is that that many companies are, if you're not growing, you're going backwards. There are some companies that are probably three or four or maybe five who are very, very strong. But there's this huge, it's like an iceberg, they're just the tip of the iceberg. Underneath that, there are so many companies that have dropped away, and there are thousands that are just eking a living out of garages that are nibbling away at everybody else's profits, margins, whatever, you know. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not here to judge. You know, people are making, scratching a living from it. But, you know, that's up to them. I have seen it change. I think it's great. I think it's absolutely great. What Nash, Fox, Corda, and people like that do, they have made carp fishing sexy. When I was carp fishing, it was not sexy. It was seen as a bit of an old man's game that you moved into. But, you know, since carp fishing's been on telly, the front of Angling Times, it is now seen as the thing. It's trendy to do, and that's great. You know, it's great for kids to want to do that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't want to push that genie back in the box. You are not going to get kids to say, I want to catch a two-ounce roach or a four-ounce roach. You're not going to ever do that. That's never going to happen.
No, I mean, carp fishing has become the entry-level fishing, which we kind of used to look down on, saying you're going to be a better angler if you've learned to fit, you know, float fish, quiver tip, ledger, whatever. But I think nowadays, carp fishing is exciting. The reason why when we hooked our first carp, didn't want to do anything else other than carp fish, you know, we can't take that away from people coming into the sport. The sport's big now. It's worth something like 1.5 billion a year in the UK economy, which is ridiculous. I mean, those half a dozen bait companies and half a dozen tackle companies, you know, in the 80s and 90s, I wouldn't have thought they were turning over a few hundred grand between them.
No, that's right.
Back then. So, I mean, it's obviously a good thing, the bigger it gets. And like you say, it's kind of cool. I do still get non-anglers saying, why is everybody on my Facebook profile pictures have a fish in the picture? They're like, it's so common now that, you know, non-anglers are saying, all the guys on my Facebook have got a fish, they're holding a fish.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think if you go in as a carp, if you go in and just fish for carp, then you will become probably a good carp angler, because that's all you know. I don't think it makes you a good angler. I think I think people get this mixed up. These are totally different things. If you want to become a good angler, I think you need to have a grounding in, as I did, tench fishing, roach fishing, pike fishing, bream fishing, eel fishing. That makes you a good angler, because you appreciate other things. But I don't think that necessarily makes you a good carp angler. I think you can become a good carp angler simply by just going carp fishing from day one. There are many of our lads who you see in the magazine now are exceptional carp anglers, but that's what they are exceptional carp anglers. They're not exceptional anglers. You know, exceptional anglers, Brian Scores, met him this weekend, he is an exceptional angler. He catches carp, perch, pike. He is what I would say an exceptional angler, because he had groundings in fishing. I'm a good angler. Brian's an exceptional angler. There are people who can fish me off the planet with carp fishing, but would be useless as an angler. But hey, that's the world, isn't it?
Yeah, it's certainly a good thing that it's getting more popular. And like I say, if people are enjoying it, then, you know, let them pick up a carp rod as the first rod. If they get that bug and they're hooked for life, and, you know, it adds goodness to their life, then happy days, you know.
The industry's better for carp fishing. It has made, you know, let's be honest, you know, match fishing, general fishing, things like that. I'm not sure that carp fishing has killed them. I think the world in general has not, you know, the advent of social media, of all the games. Remember, it's competing against a lot of things. And if somebody, kid, is saying, right, what is more sexy? Is it going on your Game Boy? Is it catching a 2-ounce roach sat on the canal? Or is it catching a 12-pound carp? You are more likely to retain a kid who's catching 12-pound carp, who sees it on the telly, who's got exciting magazines, than somebody who's sat on a canal catching 2 or 3 ounce roach. You know, I'm not saying what's right or wrong. You are more likely to keep somebody on that carp side of things than you are on the smaller side of things.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And it's, I mean, is that the only way you've seen it evolve? That the kind of
I've seen it evolve in many other ways. I've seen, you know, I've seen it, the numbers of people. It's just been incredible, isn't it? It's just taken over. The quality of tackle, you know, I've got a couple of friends, and I'm not going to say the names, and all they do is moan. And I think, well, I don't know why you're moaning, because number one, you've made a living out of it. Number two, your bed chair never creaks anymore. You're not ending up with backache. Your line never snaps. Your hooks never fail. Your bait, you never have to worry that it might blow. You know, your leads are perfect, your rods will cast 140 yards, your reels don't seize up. So it's very easy to be romantic, but the reality is that, yeah, you know, I'd love it to be where we are, but there's to be only 6,000 of us doing it. But you can't have it both ways. You know, we are where we are. And I think it's absolutely great. If I didn't like it, you know, either what they say about America, love it or leave it. You know, if you don't like carpfish, you don't do it. Do something else.
No, there's nothing worse than, I mean, considering you are an old school angler yourself, you've got a modern outlook to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know a lot of people are, you know, older than me when I was young, and now they hate the current carp scene. They don't like it. They actively put it down, and I don't know. You got to move with the times, you know. This is being bitter about, and everything changes. You know, the world.
But what was worse is it people now being genuinely excited about the fishing, putting on social media, or what about the guys who told you lies, never told you anything, wouldn't speak to you, hid everything, wouldn't give you the time of day. You know, I think it's easy sometimes to forget where you've come from. And I think some of these guys who are critical and say it was better in the past, you know, if you think about it, and this is one of the things I always say, we can say now, oh, yeah, it was better in 2005. When it gets to 2020, I bet you people are saying, well, it was better when it was 2015. It's easy to look back with rose-coloured spectacles. Yeah, I loved it. I was very innocent when I first started. I was 23. You know, I didn't have my own home to maintain. I didn't have the responsibilities. Of course it was better. Of course it was more exciting. But everything was. I won't talk about the things that were. They were really exciting in those days. I thought I was the best in the world at doing it. And I realised I wasn't.
So when did you stop becoming involved with the Carp Society?
Well, to be fair, I was involved with Carp Fisher probably until it ceased to be a magazine. So I was involved. In fact, you know, hey, I was involved with the Carp Society in that I talked last year with Richie McDonald. You know, I was one of the two main speakers at Sandown. I talked with Richie McDonald. You know, you said that to me in 1983. By the way, Jules, you'll be headlining the Carp Society show with Richie McDonald. I would have said, yeah, right, I'll have some of that stuff you're smoking. So yeah, I was involved with the Carp Society certainly until last year. You know, I was a member of, I was the editor of Carp Fisher, certainly until Paul Selman, until this ceased to be a magazine. It became an in-house magazine, didn't it? Was it published once or twice a year? Even then I wrote for it. Whenever there was a colour magazine, I wrote for the Carp Society. But I would say my active involvement ended probably about 15 years ago. But, you know, the slideshows, things like that, I've never stopped.
And with recent developments in the Carp Society with regards to Horseshoe Lake and all the stuff you see going on at the minute, the lack of members, what are your views on it, you know, as somebody that's been involved from the start?
Very sad. When I started with the Carp Society, I was unpaid editorial. And that's the way it was. The only time I ever got paid for any editorial was, I think, when Paul Selman took it over as the editor. It became a professional magazine under Layman Publications, and I got paid, I have absolutely no idea, maybe £500 a year for doing six mags, you know, nothing. It was just literally a token of appreciation for effort. Every slideshow I've ever done for the Carp Society, and I would say that's well over 100, never been paid a penny. The only thing I've ever asked for is my expenses. 50 quid of fuel, 30 quid of fuel, two glasses of orange juice, two packets of crisps. You know what? Sounds like a film on telly, doesn't it? So I always did it for free, purely and simply because in the olden days, you know, I used to watch Roger Smith, Bob Jones, Richie McDonald, Greg Fletcher, all those guys doing slideshows. And you know what? I thought, you know, in years to come, I'll put something back as well. And, you know, I was proud to be asked to do these slideshows. And, you know, I've got to remember that, you know, a lot of these people are now critical of the Carp Society who ran regions. I'm not daft. I knew that we'd get 100 people to see me talking, 200 people to see me talking. I got no fee. But I know all those went out for an engine on the Carp Society. You know, there's a lot of people who are critical of the Carp Society who had many good boozy nights, many good engines on the back of the Carp Society, you know, and that's what happens. But, you know, I think people need to be very careful before they start being critical about some aspects of the Carp Society. I'm very sad that, you know, when that they had 6,000 members once and it was a great organisation to be up with. You know, I went down to Horseshoe Lake, did many a junior fishing. Again, there was no expenses. That was, you know, my day off. You know, it's a long way down there. I did it because I believed in it was, you know, giving something back to the youngsters. And I do think that if at the end of the day, people who have been remunerated for working for the Carp Society are then going to get paid a huge payoff, I think that's wrong, personally. You know, I don't know the situation, but I think that's wrong. You know, it would be, you know, I'm not sure when those people weren't at the start of the Carp Society. I think, you know, where do you draw the line? Do you not say, well, people who came up with the horseshoe idea in the first place, people like Mike Cavan and people like that who worked their socks off to get a Horseshoe Lake, why are they not being remunerated? You know, people have been paid for being directors or governors or whatever the Carp Society, and they got a good salary, and yet they potentially, if it's true, are going to make a big wedge out of it. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I don't like the... It just feels uncomfortable to me, that.
There's something not quite right going on. I mean, we are going to go into it in more detail on the show. You know, I've been kind of filled in as much as I can of what's been going on. But it reading between the lines, and, you know, it's all being denied at the minute. But, you know, if the plans are to remove the membership, I mean, I believe they've got 11 members now, 7 of them are on the board.
I mean, I do know that they made it very difficult for people to become members, which seems very daft unless you've got a long-term plan. It may be they never actively promoted membership, they never wanted people, or they didn't seem to particularly want people to be members. Now, I cannot understand that. You know, only they know the answer why they didn't want members, you know. Maybe the answer's staring us in the face. I don't know.
They used to want members. You know, I remember fishing Horseshoe in recent years on a day ticket and being forced to buy a membership that just to fish the lake, which seemed a bit daft, but, you know, they were obviously making money by doing that. And then all of a sudden, you know, they've trebled the price of the membership and they actively discouraging you to join.
That is what they have to answer then, isn't it? Why do you actively discourage membership? You know, and if this goes down the court, you know, if this goes down the court line, you know, I know how the law works. These things don't get settled overnight. These kind of things don't get dealt with in magistrates' court or county courts. This is big stuff. This is a huge drain on people's finances, and a huge drain. It don't get settled overnight. You know, if this thing goes to court, it ain't going to be dealt with at your local court. This is going to be in the High Court.
Yeah, and whether the rumours are true or not, you know, let's assume it's been discussed that, you know, maybe they were going to sell the assets, split the money, or find a way of splitting the money legally between. I mean, these people don't deserve it. I mean, the Carp Society was for all carp anglers back in the day. It was for, you know, you felt you wanted to be a member of it. I applied to be a member when I was 14 years old. I sent them a letter telling them, listing all the fish that I'd caught that year. You know, I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be a part of this society that was in my hobby and the thing that I loved. And it's, we all own a little part of that. Yeah. And for a group of directors now that probably weren't even members themselves back then when I was a member, you know, wanting to maybe, you know, I've, Lord knows what it's been valued at, 1.7 million or something, to be divvying that up between a dozen people, it just doesn't seem right.
Oh, well, I hope it's not. I genuinely hope it's not true. I've dealing with David Manuel for many, many years. I can only say I found him a lovely bloke. So I genuinely hope it's not true. And if it is true, I don't think it's right. I'd love to hear the argument. And if there is an argument, it will be dealt with in court, and that will drain a lot of people's money. And there'll be a lot of people you can have barristers tell you what you want to hear. They'll be brave with your money. But at the end of the day, if you lose your case, they will want their fee. it's a cash cow, you know, and I genuinely hope for the Carp Society that it isn't true, and that when I see David Mangle at the next do, as I go to every do, it isn't true, and we just have the usual great day that we do, you know. But there again, I'm sure these things rumble on.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've officially denied that it's up for sale on the website, so now it's in the open. I'm presuming they're not going to be able to sell it anytime soon.
I hope so.
But then, you know, how much motivation, if that was on the agenda at one point, you know, what's going to happen to Horseshoe in the fact that it's probably been really well run at the minute, but if the powers that be above aren't particularly interested because they saw it as a nice little retirement fund or something, then
it's a lovely lake. I mean, I mean I've been there many fishings, and what a stunning place that is. And I have to say, people like Paul Boychott and people like that, they were so passionate about it, and David was passionate about it, and it was just one of those wonderful places that I think, you know, why isn't this 12 miles from my house? What a wonderfully run place, you know. And the effort that went into those Carp Society junior fishings was fantastic, you know. That's why I give my Saturdays up and drive down, you know, a long way, you know, on days off, because I thought, you know, this is great what it's doing for carp fishing. And as I say, the Carp Society have always been good to me, and I genuinely hope it's not true, and that, you know, in November or December when the next conferences, we're all just thinking, well, it was one of these rumours. You know, it'd be like a rumour me opening wallet. It's just one of those rumours that was never found to be true.
You and half of Yorkshire.
Yeah.
No, more than half.
Do you, you got some questions, Mark? You're going to crack on?
I think we've covered most of my notes, to be honest.
Yeah, we've done an hour and 10 minutes, which is generally about an hour we go for, so we're cool. Comfortably over that. Is there anything you need to get off your chest, Jules?
No, I think I've covered all the things. I think I've covered all the things that I wanted to cover, you know, that's come up. You know, I've talked about the sponsorship and things like that. You know, I've talked about I would hope that I give people a sense of reality. You know, I pick up the magazines, and even as a long-standing carp fisherman, it is kind of easy to be demoralised and get out of sync with things. And you think, whoa, just a minute, what is the real story behind those catches? What is the real story behind those heroic 30s, 40s and 50s? You know, the problem with that is they never appear in print. You never get the full story, you know. You never get the full story about these things. All you get is a picture, some words. It might say he dropped in and caught this. It won't say it was his fifth night in a row or his fourth year. And I do think with carp fishing, it is very easy to get the total run end of the stick. And I think a lot of guys give up carp fishing because they think, just, you know, wow, what am I doing wrong? And, you know, this isn't for me. You know, the reality is, by all means, be inspired by it, but don't have the waters muddied and clouded. I love looking at people with pictures of fish, but I don't, when I go and catch me 15 pounders or catch me 25 pounders or 35 pounders, think that I'm getting it wrong and, you know, what the hell. It's just, you know, we have good years, we have bad years, we have good seasons, we have bad seasons. You know, I know very, very good anglers who've had bad years, who've had bad 2 years. And the trick is to keep up in it. It's not how many times you fall down, it's how many times you get up. And that's the hardest thing, mindset.
Exactly, yeah. I can name many examples of without going into details, what you just said. The story behind the story is never quite what it's painted out to be.
No.
What's your favourite biscuit in a brew?
Oh, my favourite biscuit, of course, would be a chocolate digestive. But being one of these boring people, you're not going to believe it. I have, like, ginger biscuits, as Mark will say, you know, less calories, good for you. You know, that's what happens when you get old. You start looking at your body and thinking, you know, how can I improve this? Because, you know, nature's not been kind to me.
Oh, I don't know. I've seen you with face masks your hair's finely manicured on a daily basis. My hair was as long as yours. It fell out quite some time ago. So
the trick to that, mate, is not to get married.
I'm working on that.
Well done, mate. Yeah, maybe it'll grow back then.
Never know. Well, we'd like to say thank you. Thanks for being a great guest.
Yeah.
And thanks for taking the time out to talk to us.
Yeah, absolutely honoured, mate. As me and Tim have always said this, Tim and me go, whenever we get asked to write an article, a book, a chapter, do an interview, do a slideshow, I always go, what, me? I still don't take it for granted. And, you know, when somebody wants me to talk, I go, yeah, I'll come and do a talk. I'm still... you know, the guy who was 16 and was, you know, watching the slideshows, I'm still excited by it all. I really genuinely am. And I hope that, you know, conveys to everyone who listens to this.
It's definitely come across, and you know, it's a pleasure to speak to, and a pleasure to speak to somebody so upbeat about the whole industry and life in general.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Jules.
Yeah, cheers.
So a big thank you to Julian. He's an ambassador of carp fishing in this country, and an all-round nice guy. Always happy, always positive, and we love him. We love him.
Yeah, I've got to also say thanks, Jules, for the hospitality. You know, a couple of coffees, ginger nuts, and even a slice of lemon drizzle cake.
Lemon drizzle.
Yeah, can't fault it.
Cool. Before we wrap it up, I think we need to bring back the carp are not sheep.
Carp are not sheep.
No, carp are not sheep, but anglers are. There's one thing I've seen more and more of lately on the Facebook. Hashtags. On everything.
Yep, so some people love a hashtag. you know, three or four, yeah, or five after every post that they make. I mean, hashtag's a Twitter thing, but Facebook have tried getting onto it. It's not worked, apart from annoying people.
Yeah, it's annoyed me. It's mainly annoyed me because people usually spell things wrong after them. But when people sometimes holding up like an 18-pound common, well done, you've caught the fish. I don't need to know everything you did to catch it, every product you used. And then when you finish it off by saying hashtag carpy.
it's worse when they like have 10 words joined together and you've got to like look at it 20 times before you realise. Sticky baits are the best on the krill, get on it. Like all in one hashtag. It's just like, yeah, okay, thanks. Yes, don't jump on it, especially if you're on Facebook. Nobody, yes, reads the trending column on Facebook ever.
No, I've never even clicked on one. I didn't even really know there was one.
No, but don't forget, whenever you mention the Carpcast, it's hashtag Carpcast.
So, yeah, that is the one hashtag we endorse wholeheartedly.
Yeah. So it's been an emotional show. We've been quite controversial. I don't think we've been controversial, but there's been quite a few kind of political issues at the minute. The Carp Society one is going to drag on for a little while, I think. And I'm guessing we just hope that that lake doesn't get sold. Unless I happen to win the lottery and buy it. Apart from that one. One thing I did notice, should have been on the net actually. Helen, who owns Cromwell, a place we speak about quite a lot on here, she's decided she needs to move back home, missing her family and stuff, because they moved away and when they bought that lake. And they had some unfortunate circumstances after they purchased it. Nathan lost his dad. And unexpectedly, Nathan and his dad were going to run that lake together. And he was in at the deep end as a young lad, having to run it on his own while they were grieving. And his mum obviously grieving. And they've had it a number of years. Really took that lake forward. And they've decided it's time to sell it and kind of go back to the family. Which I don't blame them at all, but they've made it public this week. If you happen to have, I don't know what it'd be valued at, I'm assuming you can inquire, but I would be buying it tomorrow if I had the money. Check that one out if you are in the market, if you're a millionaire and you fancy probably one of the country's best day ticket lakes, then check it out. But that's it for this show. We will be back, and there are plans in the pipeline to maybe get this show weekly, advertiser dependent. There's quite a few people inquiring about advertising now. If you want to add yourself to that list, then get in touch. If you want to help support the show now, you can do it with the Amazon link that's underneath. If you're buying anything off Amazon, just click our link and we get 0.001% or something like that.
I had a look earlier on, we're up to £4.35 now.
Well, I'm sure it was £4 from it last time you asked. Last time you mentioned it. But that's the only way you can support the show at the minute. Apart from tell your friends, keep downloading it. We keep getting our numbers up. And it's all good. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.